ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Craig
and Matt
Allen.
And coming up this weekend, what a big time card, headlined by big time featherweights. We have Brian Ortega taking on El Pantera Yair Rodriguez. And when I look at this fight card coming up, I mean, holy smokes, how could you not get excited? As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP, with me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen on the respective socials. And Matt, this is one of those cards where I know it's an ABC card. It's only the third one on the network, obviously. You had Holloway versus Cater up there. Brian Ortega has been in the mix. And when you look at this fight, I mean, Matt, Ortega versus Rodriguez, obviously, there's always rumors swirling around the next guy at featherweight. And if Yair Rodriguez gets a win coming up this weekend, it's new blood for a title shot. So very exciting stuff there. Big time featherweight bouts on this card. And I don't want to give too much away, but we've had fights fall off. We've had fights added. So you're going to want to make sure to stick around with Fight Night Picks throughout fight week as things change, because we try our best to be as quick with it as we can. And I was away last week and I had the opportunity to hop on the Zooms. We added in David Onama versus Garrett Armfield. That was a crazy scrap. But Matt, overall, again, this is a big-time fight card, and I am very much for looking forward to this one.
So right now, if you're a really big sports fan in the world, there's not that much to cheer for, you know? Like, I get excited for regular season baseball, but I know a lot of people don't really follow baseball until the postseason. There's no football right now. Basketball's over. Hockey's over. So there is kind of a weird void right now for the sports fan. And this is one of those great cards to kind of give us something to do in the meantime. It's not a pay-per-view, but I would argue this is like a fight night and a half. Like, this is UFC 279 and a half, because, like you said, this is as good of a non-pay-per-view main event as you can possibly get. Yair Rodriguez is one of the most creative and exciting fighters we have ever seen in a UFC octagon. And for Brian Ortega, he's coming off a fight of the year with one of the greatest fighters of all time in Alexander Volkanovski. And like you said, this card has a lot of components that we always like when we look at a really stacked card. Not only does it have sort of the top tier of a division, there's also some other featherweight fights on this card that are incredible that just sort of let you know where all these different fighters are in reference to Ortega and Holloway and all those guys at the top of the division. So I think 145 is on fire right now, and I'm pretty happy we can showcase card for it.
Make sure you're hitting up that comment section, Matt. Last week, the folks out there were really, really filling it up throughout the week under this video. But not just that, heading on over to Fight Night Picks question mark kicks. That one's on Saturdays. This weekend, it's going to be a little bit different. We're going to shake it up because I'm going to be going to see the old Rough Riders at Touchdown Atlantic.
Am I wrong, though? I believe the card is earlier in the day, isn't it?
It is really early, so keep that one in mind. This is a Long Island card. It says on Tapology Saturday, the card or main card starts at 11 a.m. Eastern. So stay tuned for the start of question mark kicks. It will be early on. Like I said, I'm going to be down in Nova Scotia with the Rough Riders and the Toronto Argonauts of the Canadian Football League. So I'm looking forward to that. I've never been to a CFL game, but all that to say that, yeah, we're going to be switching it up. We'll do some version of the show. It'll probably be Saturday morning. It'll be live. We'll do it over Zoom or StreamYard or something, but it will be out there.
There will be content on Saturday.
There will be content. You'll be able to figure that one out, and we'll be notifying you on the YouTube community tab and on the socials. Now, Matt, we'll wrap it on up, and we'll throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen, because, again, we're amped the F up for some of these fights. We'll throw it on over to the Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
And when we're looking forward to a Fight of the Night, Matt, our guy, Arjol Dan, Beloit Quebec Canada's own, is taking on Hurricane Shane Burgos. And for Shane Burgos, looked amazing his last time out. For Charles Jourdain, he's starting to rack up some of those wins together, and he has really brought together that full, complete skill set. We saw Jourdain struggle at the start of his fight against Lando Venata with the takedowns. Then he sunk in the choke, and all's forgotten. But Jourdain really, really bringing everything together smoothly. Very much a three-level striker. And for Shane Burgos, some of the most technical and hard-hitting boxing you're going to find in this division. Some of those eye-catching striking you're going to find out there. And for Jourdain, too, it should be noted, this is first-ranked competition in the UFC. So I absolutely love this fight. I think it's going to be fireworks. I've got a soundbite drop for later on in the show, if you follow along with the Twitter, that I'm going to throw out there. But there's going to be a lot of damage.
You know that there's some French-Canadian child out there who's like, Mama, je veux Shane Burgos. And then his mom's like, hey, nous avons le Shane Burgos à la maison. Charles Jourdain is the Shane Burgos that you have at your house. They do pretty much everything the exact same, and that's why this fight's going to be incredible. Don't care about the rankings, don't care about the records, just look about how these two guys match up stylistically. You have Charles Jourdain, who is willing to eat five shots to give one of his own, and Shane Burgos is cut from the exact same cloth, so I think this is one of those fights that, okay, Shane Burgos is a decent level name, and I feel like Charles Jourdain is starting to come into his own. This could steal the spotlight from the main event by the time we get there. I could see this being one of those fights where people are talking about this on Twitter for the next three fights, and then it's like, oh my goodness, Yair versus Brian Ortega, we now get this, so this could be an incredible fight at the featherweight division.
An amazing fight. Do you have Burgos? Do you have Jourdain? Comment section, hit it up. Second pick, Triangle City taking on El Pantera. Matt, we had La Pantera winning a very controversial split decision last weekend over Courtney Casey, but when you look at El Pantera, I mean, for Yair Rodriguez, so many fight of the nights. He has five of those to his name. For Brian Ortega, right up there in the pantheon of a walking fight of the night as well. So it's hard to go with anything else on this card. And trust me, there's so many good fights. But when you break this one down, I mean, obviously, Brian Ortega, with his time away after the Max Holloway fight, leveled up in terms of his striking 100%. To complement his grappling. And if you want to see Brian Ortega grappling, I mean, look at his fight with, I don't know, Cub Swanson. How about the first choke in the first round and the second choke to finish it off in the second round? But Ortega really bringing together a complete skill set where he's primarily known as just a grappler at the start of his career. If he goes out there and primarily strikes with Yair Rodriguez, it's going to be a bad time. And when you look at Yair Rodriguez, everybody counted him out against Max Holloway, and he performed admirably in that fight. It takes two to tango and two to bring together a fight of the night performance. I can't wait for this one.
It should be an incredible fight. And last weekend's main event, we had RDA versus Fazeev, a fight that was really fun, but I think we said on this channel multiple times, it's okay, you win this fight, and then you'll probably get another fight night main event, and then that could be your title eliminator. This is that next fight for those both guys. I really do think that Yair Rodriguez and Brian Ortega are both championship quality. I know neither guy has had the belt yet, so it's kind of hard to say that they are something that they haven't been yet, but when you just watch their performances against the active champion and the former champion, you know that Yair, Brian Ortega, Volkanovski, and Holloway, it's kind of a revolving door at this point. Now, Volkanovski does look almost unbeatable, so one of these two guys is going to have to show us probably a new wrinkle of their game that we haven't seen just yet, but I'm just thinking, like, Yair versus Volkanovski, that's an incredible fight. Even Brian Ortega versus Volkanovski, too, is a fight that's going to sell and a fight that the fans would want to see. So this is one of those win-win main events where no matter what the result is, we're still guaranteed incredible fights next.
Again, let us know who you have as a fight of the night. I mean, Jingliang Salikov, that's a fun one that you're not going to want to miss. Puna Soriano, the new guard, taking on the old guard, Dalcha Lunjambula. So many to choose from. It should be a great one. So when you look at it in terms of ABC cards, the first one was Holloway versus Calvin Kattar. That was back in January 2021. The second ABC card was also last year in April, and you had Marvin Vettori against Kevin Holland in a fight where Kevin Holland landed a couple of shots, did a lot of talking, and got taken down and really worn on by Marvin Vettori. But when we look at this overall card, Matt, I mean, so many different fights to choose from. The undefeated win streak of Jack Shore taking on a tidy little win streak for Ricky Simone. And all the way through this card, there's a lot more strikers than there are grapplers, and this is one of those ones that I think a lot of people can get excited for and rally around because you have so many different ranked fighters, and when you look at it, I mean, we have former title challengers in Ortega. We have former champions in Misha Tate making her first move down to flyweight and second weight cut in as many weeks because she was getting ready for Lauren Murphy at the pay-per-view, UFC 276, Murphy off the card. So they rebooked it, but Matt, again, this is one of those ones that I'm very excited about, and we even have fighters moving up, like Dwight Grant, who got knocked out about 2 months ago, and now he's moving up to middleweight, taking on...
fighting a guy who's lost three in a row. I'm most excited for Jack Shore and Ricky Simone, though. I know we haven't given that fight as much spotlight as the others, but that's how good this ABC card is. When you're up Shore versus Simone, kind of a former top prospect versus a current top prospect, as a preliminary fight, like, that just tells you how great this card is from top to bottom.
An amazing card, again, with question mark kicks this week. It's going to be fluid, so be sure to check it out. YouTube community tab, Instagram, at Fight Night Picks, Twitter and Instagram, Craig Allen FNP, Matt Allen FNP, and the channel, at Fight Night Picks, driving that conversation over there as well as below this video, Matt. Right now, we have 12 fights to talk about. Phil Rowe, Abubakar Nurmagomedov over the wire. That fight is off and rescheduled. Looking like it's going to be that Utah pay-per-view card. So stay tuned for that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. big welcome to the UFC, to the former Invicta strawweight champ. It's Gordinha, little fat girl's what that nickname means, Emily Ducote. She's taking on a tricky fighter and a fellow former Invicta champ, albeit at atomweight, Jessica Penne. And when Jessica Penne came in off the Ultimate Fighter, she had a fight of the night and pretty well fight of the year against Randa Markos years and years ago in 2014. And it's been a rocky road for Penne.
What were you doing in 2014?
I was in university. I was switching from chemical engineering to business, Matt.
I was in grade 10. Just to put it out there, it's been a very long time. That's all.
It's been a minute. But when you do look at this fight, I mean, for Penne, she had the win streak. She fought Joanna Jędrzejczyk. She got her face beat in, melted like a stick of butter in July. And then after that, had to pick up the pieces. And by picking up the pieces, she took about a year off, got finished by Jessica Andrade, then went out and lost the fight where, listen, you think, hey, maybe she's going to beat Danielle Taylor. Both these women have fought Danielle Taylor. One of them knocked him out in a highlight reel, but it wasn't Jessica Penne. So Penne loses to Taylor, and then she goes through a bit of a dark abyss of a USADA issue, we'll call it. And she's off for years and years, about 4.5 years. And when Jessica Penne, there were rumblings that she was going to come back into the UFC, into active competition, it was like, okay, we have to temper our expectations a little bit. Because for Penne, great strikes from the long range, not a lot of head movement, little bit of power. But when it comes to it, she gets her bread buttered with her ground game. I mean, you did see that in her last fight, taking on Karolina Kowalkiewicz. She's baiting her to the ground, and then Karolina goes, well, that looks like fun. I want that. And then, yeah, she got submitted quickly and easily by Penne with her premier submission. But when you look at Penne's fight back, I mean, she took on a fighter in Lupita Godinez who was making her UFC debut. And it was one of those ones where Godinez, also a champion from a different organization, also good boxing, good on the ground, good with the wrestling. And in that fight, we got a little bit of a non-starter, but I think a lot of people have been a little bit more excited about Penne, just considering this is an older fighter, 4.5 years off. Now she's won 2 in a row, and she did look very good her last time out.
She did look really good her last time out, but I'm going to push back against one thing that you said. I don't think Jessica Penne is a good striker whatsoever, and I don't really think she does have pop in the end of her strikes. She does like to walk almost like a Sean Strickland walking forwards with Alex Pereira. That was always the thing that stood out to me when she fought Joanna Jędrzejczyk. Like, hey, was there a coach that really sat her down and said, you know what's a great idea? Let's walk forwards with our hands down by our waist and just accept damage the whole entire time, because that was her game plan. And other than a few outside kicks from the outside, I really don't think Penne can do that much striking-wise with a lot of opponents at the UFC level. She's not a fighter who accepts other fighters closing the distance well on her because she doesn't have great punching power. So if you are someone like Emily Ducati, not that she's this like Jessica Andrade powerhouse, but there is a way to have success against Penne. If you get on the inside, you can make it uncomfortable for her, but it is a very fine line because if you get too far on the inside, that's when she is able to use some of her judo. She's a very tall fighter for this division, so she does have do a very good job of wrapping up a fighter, even on the back foot. The issue is, though, she leaves her chin very exposed when she does go for some of these clinch works, and that's something I've always worried about. I mean, Jessica Andrade is one fighter to be able to take advantage of it, but that's just a hole that keeps on showing up, whether she's taking the time off or not. And that's just something that I don't really think she's going to be able to fix no matter what stage of her career that she's at. I just look at Pena, and it's a very stifling game. I don't really look at her and think, okay,
who's Pena?
Jessica Penne, sorry. Jessica Penne is someone who can go out there, and it's more how does she negate the other fighter's positives. And in a fight against Emily Ducati, I think she can clinch her up really well, and I do think that her ground control will be a really important part of this fight. I'm just curious to see if Penne can stay active enough to deal with Ducati on the feet.
That's it. When you look at Jessica Penne, she's got good length. She's got a decent amount of pop at the end of her shots, but where I was going with her striking is, offensively, it's not so bad. It's low-ish output. Like, you look at it throughout her UFC tenure, 10 UFC fights, 2.41 significant strikes per minute. UFC average is 3.38, so she's below average in what she's throwing out. And her defensive numbers are skewed because she got the tar beat out of her in the Andrade fight and the fight against Joanna Jędrzejczyk. But still those same holes in Penne's game, to the fact that she holds her hands low about chest height and she holds her head up and out like a lot of taller fighters will do in these divisions. So we flip the script and we talk about Emily Ducote, and you figure this is a fighter that way back when she was fighting with Bellator as a very young fighter. Obviously, she has 2 losses, one against Salima Leigh McFarlane very early on. It's her third fight with Bellator, and that one was for nothing. It was just for fun. But if you do focus on it, she did have a title shot after that. Got armbarred in that fight. Lost the decision the first time she fought Halima Leigh McFarlane. Then she goes on to lose split decision to Christina Williams, the warhorse. And then she loses to Vida Arteaga. And at that point, Emily Ducote is a fighter that's 6-5 in her overall career. And it's really hard to tell what kind of a career trajectory she's going to take. I mean, this is a fighter that's really set herself up well at Oklahoma City, at American Top Team. She's somebody that I've seen feature prominently in a lot of different fighters' camps. But when you do look at it for Emily Ducote, I mean, great boxing. And I know she recently, I think it was 7 weeks ago on her Instagram, she just got her Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. And that's great to see. But that's kind of the last piece of her game that we really do see. Because if you watch these fights out of Emily Ducote, and I should mention, 6-5 at a point, she goes on to beat Catherine Paprocki, submits her, submits Janaysia Maranjan, former title challenger over with Invicta. She fights Kanako Murata, and in that fight, really the only thing I could say, and the only way that you can see a fighter beating somebody like Emily Ducote, is if you try again and again and again to take her down. She has great defensive hips. She has a great first move. But for Kanako Murata, that was it. It was just chaining takedowns together, really, really throwing the kitchen sink at her with a grappling. And that's how Murata got the win. But after that, a win over Juliana Lima in a close enough fight where Lima won the first round. And then old lady Lima started to slow down round two, round three against Danielle Taylor. If you've never seen that knockout, like, it is heavy right hand. Taylor's knocked out standing, and then the referee doesn't jump in, so Ducote throws a head kick that drops Taylor and completely knocks her out. And then against Alicia Zapatella, that was a weird fight because Ducote won the belt to beat Danielle Taylor, and then Alicia Zapatella had just lost her atomweight belt, so off a loss, Zapatella gets a fight up at strawweight. And if you look at Zapatella, she's 4'11".
I felt like that was a step back in competition, if we are being completely honest.
Zapatella is a very good grappler when she's in her own positions, and she is at atomweight, but a strawweight at 4'11", she just, if you've ever seen a Zapatella fight, it's a lot of looping shots, it's a lot of trying to close the distance, get the takedown. And in that one, Ducote, very measured with her strikes, great jab, great 1-2, really good at throwing selective leg kicks, but she's not a big kicker. And when you boil it down for Ducote, her best path to victory is just staying measured, throwing those basic boxing combinations, and really pressuring your opponent to wait until they make a mistake.
I don't think Jessica Penne can strike with Emily Ducote whatsoever in this fight. If Penne's going to have success, she's going to have to be very clinch heavy. Now, she's not going to have to get her own takedowns based off all those clinches, but I really do think that's going to be her X-factor position throughout this fight, because again, other than some lazy kicks to the body, there's no consequences for striking with Jessica Penne. You can get on the inside, you can land your own strikes, because again, her punches come from her hips, but there's no power behind them because her feet are never set when she strikes. The good thing about Ducote is at least she does set her feet when she strikes, because it allows her to go in for the takedown if she wants to go for it. It allows her to mix in her own kicks if she wants to. I just think this fight really comes down to look at Ducote more as like a striker and look at Pena more as a grappler, because I don't know how much success Emily can have on the mat with Penne, especially if she finds herself underneath. But I do think her takedown defense is good enough to at least keep this fight at range in the middle of the cage. And it's not like I think Penne's going to go on to just lose a bunch of fights. Like, she has looked better in her last two performances. It's just, this isn't the same fighter who was on The Ultimate Fighter, who people thought was going to challenge for the title. I think she does seem, not washed, because that's too extreme of a term, I just don't think she's in her prime anymore, because it has been a really long time since she was that great Invicta fighter who had the wild fight with Michelle Waterson that a lot of people remember her for. So I do like Emily Ducote in this matchup, but I am curious to see if Penne can go on sort of a second career run.
Both fighters, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belts, obviously, for Penny. She's had hers for quite a long time, training out of Alliance and the respective close by gyms. This fight was originally announced June 2nd. It was supposed to be Jessica Penny against Brianna Fortino, formerly Van Buren, but Ducote steps in on short notice. You look at the odds in this one. Penne opened a plus 115, still roughly there. Emily Ducote opened a minus 135, minus 140, or thereabouts. We have a look at the Tapology votes, and listen, I'm going to say it's not a surprise to us, but it will be to you, Matt. It is a surprise to us. I'm going to say over under 70% for the younger fighter.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. No, it's slightly under. 621 total votes. 63% for Emily Ducote. 72% by decision. 21% by knockout. For the 37% that have Penne, 75% by decision and 13% by submission. You've already made your pick. You're on with Jessica Penne.
Penne's not a great striker. I'm sorry. She doesn't put volume together, and she doesn't have great power. power. If you don't have great power, but you have great volume, you can still outstrike yourself in a lot of situations, or outstrike your opponent, I should say. For Pena, it's a lot of be on the back foot, hope that you wrap them up in the clinch, and hope that you drag them down to the ground. Her takedowns aren't traditional, and I don't mean that in a positive way. Like, Alexander Romanov's takedowns aren't traditional, but they're very, very good because they're unique to him. For Pena, it is a lot of hope that she gets that head and arm throw, hope that she can get on top with that, and I do think Ducati's a good enough grappler to where if she does find herself in one of those head and arm throws, I think she'll be able to scramble out the back door from that position a lot, because I don't think Pena's solid enough in the top position to just keep on going back to that over and over and over again. Now, UFC Octagon, or Jitters, Octagon Jitters, we should talk about that, but the good thing is, Ducati's fought some pretty big organizations throughout her career, so I'm not really worried about her coming over and, you know, the big lights being too much for her. Like you had said, fought for the title against Alina Leigh McFarlane in Bellator, has some really high-profile fights in Bellator, too. I remember she lost the Christina Williams fight right after the Alina Leigh matchup, and that was a really hyped-up fight at the time for Bellator, so for Ducati, if you remember her as the fighter who was in Bellator, you might be kind of low on her right now, but I do feel like she has been able to improve since that time.
Yeah, if you look at it for Emily Ducati, I mean, she's beaten Juliana Lima, UFC vet. She's beaten Danielle Taylor, UFC vet, somebody that has a win over Jessica Penne, albeit years ago, but for me, this is the one key that you have to watch out for, because I think Jessica Penne, as an underdog, has a great shot. I think that Lupi Godinez is better than Emily Ducati, and I think Lupi Godinez beats her 8 out of 10 times. But again, I thought that Godinez beat Jessica Penne in that fight. It was a little bit of a non-starter, but when I do look at this fight, for Ducati, she's got upper volume. In a lot of her fights, it's a lot of double jab, triple jab, right hand, with a little bit of a leg kick. It's very, very low volume. There's a chance that Jessica Penne really wraps her up and gets ahead on the scorecards with just the accumulation of cage control time, which sounds insane, but the judges are weird these days. So I do like Emily Ducati because the best part of her game is she has this ringwomanship about her where she really controls the aspects of the fight and where these fights have taken place, especially on this run where she's gone 5-1 since Bellator. So both of us in this matchup going with the younger fighter making her UFC debut in Emily Ducati. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Big time fights coming up. My personal favorite, Charles Jourdain taking on Shane Burgos. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. On April 23rd, there's a welterweight in this world. His name is Sergey Khandoshko. His nickname is Honda, and he knocked out a man, Matt. And he knocked out a man like a full-sized minivan. We're talking about Khandoshko knocking out Dwight Grant back April 23rd. So what does Grant do? He picks up the pieces and about 2 months later moves up a weight class to middleweight to take on 0-3 UFC fighter, the former champ with We Love MMA. It's Dustin Stoyfus. And when I look at this fight, it really is weird because when I went back in my notes, like I've looked at Dwight Grant's career coming in off of Dana White's Contender Series, and it's been a little bit of a blur. He's had some of the worst fights in UFC history, like his fight against Zach Otto.
The Alain Jobin one was terrible.
He's had the best knockout ever against Carlo Pedersoli, where he pretty well lost the whole first round until the last second of the round when he knocks him out with a head kick. For Dwight Grant, you know the power's there. The show-stopping abilities are there. I mean, he almost finished Daniel Rodriguez until Daniel Rodriguez rallied right back and finished Dwight Grant. It's just been an odd bucket of muscles for the guy who represents Alliance and AKA. And I've seen some interviews out there this week where Dwight Grant's kind of talked about going back to the basics, training at AKA with Daniel Cormier, with Habib. But he has been an Alliance guy, so that's what I threw up there for the graphics. But when you look at it for Grant, it all boils down to the fact that he has those defensive grappling metrics to go along with his striking. You know how good the power is, but the guy has the lowest output ever, and I'm really eager to see how he makes out at middleweight because he hasn't fought at middleweight in about a decade, and it's an odd one, late career change move, and I have to throw this out there, giant red flag. You get knocked out like a month, month and a half, 2 months ago, and then you come back and you're 37. It's an odd one.
Who was it on the last card who had just got knocked out, but they look good in their return? Not to put you on the spot. I just remember there was someone on the last card who was coming off.
It was a 4 month
exactly, layoff. But that's what I was going to say. He was into that 4 to 6 month layoff where you don't really worry as much, but I agree with you 100%.
Jamie Mullerkey was,
Dwight Grant making such a fast turnaround is very concerning, but the good news is, I kind of think I might like Dwight Grant at middleweight. Now, just because I said it doesn't mean I'm right, but I'm going to give you these reasons for why I believe so. Dwight Grant, like you said, a very long-rangey guy for the welterweight division, someone who definitely has to cut quite a bit of weight to get down to that weight class. You brought up the D-Rod fight. Like, Dwight Grant looks quite a bit bigger than Daniel Rodriguez in that fight, at least range-wise and how he uses his body. So I do think him moving up to middleweight, I don't expect Dwight Grant to be some massively undersized fighter at this division. And the good thing is, he is fighting a guy who's not really known for his own punching power. So on the feet, I'm not as concerned about Dwight Grant as I would be if he was fighting like a Sean Strickland, maybe coming off of a loss. Still not really known for his punching power, but a guy who can put strikes together who can hurt you if he hits you clean. This fight is very interesting though, because for Strikeforce, he was very promising coming into the UFC, and we just really haven't seen that guy yet. And in flashes, you'll see good output, you'll see good grappling here and there, but it just feels like he always knows how to lose a fight by the end of it, and it's so frustrating to watch, because I think these guys, they're both one minor shift away from becoming, not a contender, but just becoming a legitimate unranked fighter. Like you said, if Dwight Grant could just up his output to what like a UFC standard level would be, I mean, he's got great power, he's got a good jab, he's got good kicks, he's got good takedown defense. If he just had that last and finish Stone, then I really do think he would be a tough fight for anybody on the outskirts of the top 15. But this fight's really going to test A, his takedown defense against a much bigger guy, and B, how good is his chin? Because if Dustin can move around a lot and get Dwight Grant to meet him halfway with one of his strikes, not hit him just one punch for sake, but use his feet, skirt around the cage, make Dwight Grant make a mistake, then maybe Dustin could catch him clean and hurt him.
Dustin Stoicefist has fought a wicked level of competition for a guy coming into the UFC, lost to Kyle Daukaus in a bit of a non-starter. You got to grapple by a guy who is widely regarded as a good grappler, but has also had some ups and downs in the UFC. He lost to Rodolfo Vieira late in their fight in the third round, another guy that you don't want to mess around with. And he did get submitted by Gerald Meerschaert his last time out, a guy who has the most submissions in UFC middleweight history with 8.
He has been submitted, though.
When you look at this fight, Matt, for Dustin Stoicefist, there's going to be a lot of people that say, this guy's 0-3, he sucks, forget about him. Go back and watch his fights before the UFC. This is a guy that would switch it up, switch stances, throw nice lead hooks from either stance, double up on his jab, and he has a bit of an odd story coming into the sport of mixed martial arts because he was a guy that was raised Pennsylvania Dutch, so spoke a little bit of German. He's trained a lot in German. Normally billed out a Planet Eater. Seems like for this camp, he's been training in the States, but I went through and looked at it. Like, you consider the background of Stoicefist, his background's lucha libre, and it's not something that you hear very often. And Matt, you give me a dingus look.
For good reason, though. Lucha libre doesn't make MMA champions.
Claudio Poyas is a lucha libre background guy, and Marco Huas was too.
How many MMA champions at the UFC level have we seen with lucha libre? It's just not a common mixed martial art for guys to translate over to this sport.
Okay, let's focus on Dustin Stoicefist's finishes that he has by submission. He has 5 total submission wins, 1 by twister, 1 by guillotine, 2 by rear naked choke, and 1 by knee bar. He's very, very dynamic with his takedown attempts when he's given the opportunity to be offensive. You look at the guys that he's fought in the UFC, Kyle Daukaus isn't going to give you that opportunity. Rodolfo Vieira certainly isn't, unless he gasses, which he didn't in that fight. And then his last time out against Gerald Meerschaert, wasn't able to get it done. Now, when I look at Dwight Grant, I look at the 5-1-in. Again, we talked about the Alan Joban fight. There was a point deducted in that fight. It was very, very lackluster. And if you look at it, that's this fifth to last fight 3 years ago. His fight against Danny Rodriguez almost 2 years ago, a loss. He beats Stefan Sekulic in a fight most people thought Stefan Sekulic won that fight. He loses to Francisco Trinaldo by split decision. This is not the first time I'm going to talk about Masur Anduba eye-poking somebody and losing a point. Lost a point in this one against Muslim Salikov. He just eye-poked as many times as he wanted because nobody was taking any points. And for Dwight Grant, his last time out, had a wild fight against Sergey Kondashko, but got knocked down a couple of times. That fight about 2 months ago. So when I do look at this one, again, pre-UFC, Stoicefist mixed it up. Dwight Grant has way more power than Dustin Stoicefist. I don't care if it's at 170. I think Dustin Stoicefist would have to lose like 20 pounds of muscle to make 170 and cut off half his arm. But when you look at a guy like Dwight Grant, this is his first fight at 185 since 2011 with the Reality Fighting promotion. So good opportunity for both guys. But I mean, Matt, you look at Stoicefist, a Dana White's Contender Series guy as well, slammed his way into the UFC, hurting Joseph Feifler's arm. And for Dwight Grant, he got a good win over there on the Contender Series as well. But when we do look at the odds for this fight, Grant open minus 175. He's about a minus 170 right now. Stoicefist, the underdog, looking for his first UFC win. Open plus 150, plus 140. We have a look at the Tapology votes. They're a surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Grant.
I'll say over.
Just because he's more well-known. Yeah, 625 total votes, 73% Grant, 34% by decision, 58% by knockout. For the 28% that have Stoicefus, 55% by decision, 24% by submission, 11% by knockout. So in this matchup, again, Grant has the experience in the UFC, has UFC wins as well, and he has that finishing power. Is he going to be able to get it done this weekend?
What I do like about Dwight Grant is, even when he loses, it's because he's trying to win the fight. And a lot of the times, I would much rather a fighter be almost too reckless for their own good than not want to get into that state to begin with. And that's my problem with Dustin Stoicefus. I just don't know if he's willing to stand in the pocket, eat a shot to give a shot, and do that consistently round after round. Now, for Dwight Grant, again, I cannot put enough red flags on what you said at the start of the video, just about his quick turnaround coming off that knockout loss, because that was a legitimate knockout loss. He was really out of it, and that was a good stoppage. So I'm a little bit worried about Grant's durability in this matchup. But again, Dustin's not the heaviest hand at middleweight. So I do think Dwight Grant, just stylistically, may have got himself a decent matchup in his middleweight debut. So I'm ever so slightly going to pick Dwight Grant. But I will say this, more than any other fight on the card, I am very curious to see how these two guys match up physically with each other on the scales. Because if Dwight Grant does look Dustin face-to-face, eye-to-eye, and he looks like he's a real middleweight, then I will be much more confident with Dwight Grant than I am right now. But ever so slightly, I'm leaning on the fence thinking about going to the natural middleweight, but I'm going to pick Dwight Grant.
I listened to an interview that Grant did with Low Kick MMA a couple of weeks ago, and he talked about the weight cut for this camp and the fact that he can actually eat. He weighs about 200 to 210, so doesn't have to cut all that weight from 200 to 210 to get to 170, so he's happy. He's loving it, this and that. I don't pick guys that get knocked out that soon. So a guy that got knocked out a couple of months ago, making the move up a weight class somewhat of short notice. I mean, yeah, you get a full training camp. He probably took a couple of weeks off anyway. I go with Dustin Stoicefus. I mean, again, Dwight Grant has been training this camp to defend the takedown, which isn't the biggest part of his game. Don't get me wrong. He has decent takedown defense. But for Stoicefus, that is the crown jewel of his game. So I'm going to go with the guy representing Pennsylvania in this one, the underdog to get his first UFC win. I've got Dustin Stoicefus. Matt has the body snatcher, not Donald Sutherland out of St. John, New Brunswick, Canada.
Oh, I just think 21 Savage. I missed a body catcher, slide a gang soul. No? No.
Body catcher, body snatcher, two different things.
I know, but then it's body catcher, soul snatcher. It puts the two together, Craig. Come on now.
Matt's got Dwight Grant. Enjoy the fights. Listen, you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, light heavyweight striker strike. We have wicked win streaks on the line as Dustin Jacoby puts his 7-fight unbeaten streak on the go against the 14-fight win streak of Dawen Jung. Now, I should mention there's draws hidden in there, and it is truly 14 wins and a draw for Dawen Jung and 7 wins and a draw for Jacoby. You look at those draws, Jacoby gets 10-8 against Iwan Kutsalaba, and then he rallies back round 2 and round 3 for Dawen Jung. A fight against Sam Alvey that ends in a draw. There was a 10-8 in there, and Dawen Jung had a rally in the third round of that fight, which is something that if you lose the first two rounds, it's hard to really put a stamp on the end of it. Jung was able to do that, but when you do look at the competition these guys have faced, it is the far more intensive for Dustin Jacoby. And I say that with a few caveats because he is a guy that has glory kickboxing lineage. And when I say that, there might be some fans out there that go, geez, I don't really watch kickboxing, I don't pay attention, but you will know the name, of course, Alex Pereira. He spent time with that promotion. Carl Robertson that you saw here last weekend just get absolutely beaten down by Kennedy and Zetchiku, a guy that we'll talk about in this breakdown. He also competed with Glory as well as Israel Adesanya. And when you look at it for Dustin Jacoby, we got knocked out inside of 2 minutes by Alex Pereira over with Glory.
It's going to happen.
Has a couple of losses to Simon Marcus. But he beat Carl Robertson over with Glory, so that is important. And when you look at it for Jacoby, two different entries into the UFC. Lost to, who was it, Clifford Starks his first time out. And then he had a loss to Chris Camozzi. Picked up the pieces, had some MMA fights outside of the organization. Got big time into kickboxing. But now he sports a squeaky clean record where he had lost to John Salter years ago with Bellator. Reinvented himself as more of a striker. Polished things up. Beats Cody East in MMA. Gets another win. Comes into the UFC and goes on this run. But we look at the level of guys that Jacoby's been able to beat here in his last 5 fights. Max Griechen, a tough fight. You look at the other win over Darren Stewart. He finishes him. He beats John Allen pillar to post. And then his last time out, Jacoby's taking on Michael Oleschaychuk. And Matt, that's a hot prospect. And I know Oleshchyk's been hot and cold in some of his fights, but for Dustin Jacoby, he's got to be
He's the 16th ranked fighter in the division.
If he's not ranked now, that's what I was going for.
And I love Lord Michael, but prospect might be a stretch too far at this point. This is a really fun fight, though, and I gotta be honest, I really enjoy watching this version of Dustin Jacoby in the octagon. Like, when he fights, I get really excited for them because it is very traditional. It's nothing like Yair Rodriguez. Like, we talk about Yair. He's a great Taekwondo practitioner, but he mixes it with his boxing.
15th ranked is 50. Dustin Jacoby.
Perfect. Well, that's nice to see him in the rankings because for the longest time, he was okay. You've lost a couple fights in the rankings, now you gotta fight Dustin Jacoby. Or, hey, you're a really bright prospect, now you gotta fight Dustin Jacoby. And he is a tough fight because he's a good combination of takedown defense, he has a good chin, he has phenomenal striking too, and I can't stress this enough. It's nothing flashy, it's nothing that's really gonna make you say, wow, spinning back fist or anything, but he knows how to work behind a jab, he knows how to throw elbows in the clinch, he knows how to throw a straight right and a right hook, and honestly, that's more what we can say about a lot of fighters at this division because he throws with variety, and that's what I really like out of Dustin Jacoby. He's not someone who will just do jabs and right hands and then that be the end of his combination. He'll throw the right hand followed up with a left hook to the body. There's some really cerebral combinations out of Dustin Jacoby that I do like when he's able to back up his opponent, but that's really going to be the story of this fight. Whoever's pushing the other one back, be Daun Jung or Dustin Jacoby, they're probably going to be the one having the most success, because for Daun Jung, I do really like his strikes on the outside too, but I don't like his defensive striking whatsoever. And against a guy like Dustin Jacoby, if he does walk into that power and meet it halfway, Jacoby can knock you out with like a glancing shot over the guard. If you meet him halfway, almost like Sam Alvey did with our boy there who was carrying groceries, it can end very poorly. I'm just very surprised matchmaking wise that Jacoby is fighting backwards in the rankings, because like you said, you get a win over Oleshchyk, the way he looked against John Allen, like those are great performances that normally you'd want to build a guy up after. So I am a little bit surprised to see him almost fighting backwards in Daun Jung, who's a very dangerous fighter himself, who doesn't really have the notoriety that some other fighters might have.
And you look at it for Daun Jung, his last loss was a submission to UFC heavyweight Roky Martinez over with Top FC in 2015. He's gone in this wild win streak. I'd say the biggest win outside of the UFC. He beat Hulk, a former police officer and professional wrestler. You go look him up if you've never seen him. But inside of the UFC, a win over forever prospect, but never cashing those checks by standing guillotine. Hadis Ibrahimov beat slow Mike Rodriguez inside of the first round. The split draw to Sam Alvey. Then he beat William Knight by out-wrestling him, and he had 8 takedowns in that fight? He beat Kennedy and Zechiku his last time out. That was back in November. And that's a win that, just if you only watched Kenny and Zechiku's last fight last weekend against Carl Robertson, you know, Daun Jung knocked him out in the first round, you'd be like, holy shit, this guy, he's going to fight for the title. 14 fight win streak, and he beat Kenny and Zechiku. Start cashing the checks now. Back up a bit, because Kennedy, that was the non-starter Kennedy in that fight. That was the hold on, wait, raise your arm for guard, just hold off. And Daun Jung was throwing elbows in tight in open space. Like, he looked amazing in that fight, but you kind of hit the nail on the head, and this is what I had in my notes, underlined and highlighted. Great jab from both guys. When you watch Daun Jung, from Jacoby, he uses the jab to set up his right hand, whether it's a cross or he throws the hook out there. For Daun Jung, 1, 2, triple it up, back his opponent up, get them up against the cage, and that's where Daun Jung, similar to Dustin Jacoby, Jung can do a lot of his work, but differently than Jacoby. For Jacoby, he's going to try and get you up against the fence. He gets backed up a lot in his fights, and then he has to kind of get the plum clinch, snap the neck of his opponent, spin them around, and then get out of it. When you look at Daun Jung, backing them up, he's usually a lot bigger, and again, in this fight, he only has a few inches of height and reach, but backs them up, and he's so top-heavy that he can hold guys up against the fence, start to throw the uppercuts, throw to the body a little bit, whip in elbows as well, but when you look at Daun Jung, he's definitely the more complete martial artist, but when you look at Daun Jung, take that striking that Daun Jung has, and for Dustin Jacoby, just turn it up quite a bit, because the pop at the end of his shots, and again, some of those odd angles when he dips and throws a shot, you look at it and you might not think that that's going to be a glancing blow that hurts somebody, and then it does.
I could not agree more. Joe Lewis, way back in the day, fought a guy named Schmeling, and it was a very, very historic fight. I know Craig's going to grab a book because he always does, and I bring up anything boxing-wise. Joe Lewis lost to this guy, though, and the reason he lost to the German fighter was that the German fighter had access to film, and back then, no one did. This is the 30s. No one was able to watch film. He was able to realize that Joe Lewis didn't move when he threw his jab. He threw a naked jab and didn't move his head. So Schmeling was able to slip the jab, hit him with the right hand, knocked him out in, I believe, round 14 or 15. It was near the end of the fight, and back then boxing fights used to be 15 rounds. Jacoby can strike moving backwards and forwards, and that's what I really like out of him. And the thing is, you're right, both guys do throw jabs. Jacoby can switch his up, though. He can throw a hard jab, he can throw a rangefinder jab, and he does tend to move his head while he throws it, which is going to help him get away from a potential counter from Dae-Yoon Jung. And that's why I do like Jacoby in this matchup. I think his grappling is good enough to negate the takedown attempts from Jung, if that's where the fight does get to. And the other thing I'll say is, Jacoby, for the most part, fights at a pretty even pace. There's no big peaks and valleys throughout his fights. He doesn't fight with crazy volume because he knows he has one punch knockout power. For Dae-Yoon Jung, I do worry to see about what his cardio looks like if he does go for a lot of takedowns early and he's not able to get them. If Jacoby can't just dig underhooks, like you said, get his back off the cage and then do his own damage, those are all going to be moments where everything is going in Jacoby's favor. And Dae-Yoon Jung, I just don't know how much success he can have on some of those in-betweens, because you're right, he has really good dirty boxing. I just don't think his dirty boxing is enough to outweigh some of the Muay Thai skills that Dustin Jacoby has on the inside with his own elbows and his own dirty boxing.
Higher output in the UFC from Dustin Jacoby, 5.3 significant strikes landed per minute to 4.03 of Dae-Yoon Jung. Jung has higher numbers in terms of his grappling, but again, they're heavily weighted by the 8 takedowns against William Knight. And again, for takedown defense, 58% for Jacoby. That considers both stints in the UFC. For Dae-Yoon Jung, 88% takedown defense since debuting in 2019. We have a look at the odds. Jacoby open, minus 110. So both guys at par. Jacoby, minus 150 right now. Plus 125 for Dae-Yoon Jung. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. I think they're going to be close. I'm going to say over under 60% Jacoby.
I think they'll be over.
I think they're going to be under. Oh my goodness, 50-50. So 687 total votes for the 50% that have Dae-Yoon Jung, 54% by decision, 38% by knockout. For the 50% that have Jacoby, 78% by decision, 13% by knockout. Matt, you've been like a pitcher tipping pitches. I know you have Dustin Jacoby. There's no surprise here.
Well, he's beaten much better guys at the UFC level. And I know Kennedy has looked good as of late, but you're right. It really depends on what night you catch him. It's kind of like, well, there's a lot of fighters like this. I always bring up Jamie Mullock. He's a good example because he's got stopped a number of times in the past. But if you don't stop him early, he can make the fight really ugly late. I think Dustin Jacoby, with that win over Oleksiychuk, he didn't just beat him by being strong. He beat him by being smart, too. And that's just the last little wrinkle that a lot of these guys need before they get into the rankings. I don't think Jacoby's going to become a top 7, a top 10 light heavyweight, but I really do think he'll be firmly entrenched in that 10 to 15 range, and I do expect him to get the win over Dae-Yoon Jung, because both guys' skill sets are quite complementary. I just don't think Jung's going to be able to go to his grappling enough times to really make Jacoby think enough on the feet.
I'm eager to see what we get out of Dae-Yoon Jung, because Ioan Cutsalaba had a lot of success in the first round of that fight, wasn't able to keep it up. For Dae-Yoon Jung against William Knight, he just kept going to the well, and that's a big guy that you're taking down over and over, and his cardio stayed throughout the fight, but we saw that fight against Sam Alvey where he didn't really start off all that hot. Fix those problems in his next fight, and especially in his last fight against Kenny Zechku. I have just Dustin Jacoby as well. More varied strikes, and that's what I like out of him, but this is a great fight, and I really want to hear from the folks down in the comment section, because I'm sure we're going to get a lot of different opinions on this.
Oh, without a doubt, like you said, Kenny Zechku is a very, very good fighter, and the fact that Dae-Yoon Jung has a first-round stoppage over a guy of that caliber just tells you how skilled he is. I just like the more steadiness that I've seen out of Jacoby, but like you said, this is a great fight.
Both of us going with the Hanyak Dustin Jacoby out of Factory X Muay Thai. Let us know down below in that comment section again who you have. We get some big time fights coming up on this card, including our main event between Brian Ortega and Yair Rodriguez. You're gonna want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Those of you listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, we thank you. You're rating, you're reviewing, you're doing a great job out there, and we certainly do appreciate it. But for those who are watching on YouTube, the bread and butter of the show, you're going to be looking at the graphic in front of us, and you're going to think to yourself, boy, that looks Frankenstein together. And you'd be right, because we have a Frankenstein fight. Herbert Burns taking on Bill Algeo. And listen, Algeo's way too big in the picture, but I'll explain why, because Algeo originally due to be taking on Billy Quarantillo this weekend. For Herbert Burns, lost his first UFC fight, decided I'm going to take forever off and away, and then he was supposed to take on Hussein Ashkabov, a guy who was making his UFC debut. He was undefeated. Ashkabov was the favorite. I didn't understand why, because he hadn't really fought anybody, but alas, Burns gets to take on a much higher level of competition. And I say that not lightly, but for Bill Algeo, it's been a wild run so far in the UFC. Since he fought Ricardo Lamas and got his legs kicked to crap.
Good fight, though, for his debut.
Since he fought Spike Carlisle, a guy whose cardio went off a cliff. Since he fought Ricardo Ramos, who took him down time and time again. Since he fought Joe Anderson Brito, who tried to take him down, then couldn't take him down anymore and got outstruck. For Bill Algeo, the King of Prussia, Senor Perfecto. I mean, this is a guy out of King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. And when you look at it for Algeo, out of Algeo's MMA and kickboxing, that really is the biggest part of his game. You look at him compared to other featherweights, he's got length. Once he establishes distance, it's really hard to close that gap against him in his fights. Doesn't necessarily check leg kicks all that well. Doesn't really handle takedowns all that well. But when you do look at Algeo, on his best day, he looks like a ranked fighter. And on his worst day, you kind of scratch your head and go, did we maybe miss the mark? Was it too late bringing him into the UFC?
And that's what I like about Bill Algeo. Like, the foundation is very strong of his skills. He does have decent takedown defense, although it does get pushed in some of his fights. I would say that it's been an improving component of his game, but that's going to be the thing that's going to get tested the most in this matchup by far, because I genuinely do not think Herbert Burns can stand with Bill Algeo, even for 5 minutes. And
no, I just want to add to your point, sorry, before you get too far into it. For Bill Algeo, you look at the takedown defense, UFC and Dana White's Contender Series adjacent. Loughnane took him down on 3 of 8 attempts. Lamas took him down on 5 of 11 attempts. Spike Carlisle on 4 of 13. Ramos on 8 of 13. And then his last time out, Joe Anderson Brito 2 of 4 before Brito's cardio started to slow.
I know, so it's been the part of his game that he's been improving since he came to the UFC, because everybody knows Bill Algeo is going in there to kickbox with them. So if you're going in with a kickboxer, unless you're Sean Strickland, what's the game plan? You're probably going to try to take him down. Herbert Burns, though, is going to find this a very difficult matchup, and this is why I believe so. He's not known for phenomenal cardio himself. He is somebody who can get tired as the fight goes on, and he leaves his body wide open for a guy in Bill Algeo, who really does like to go to the body with his own kicks. And I think that's going to be really difficult for Herbert Burns, because you're going to bring up the Teddy Atlas quote, oh, water in the basement. It really is key, especially in a 3-round fight, that I do expect to be fought at a very high pace, because I think Burns kind of realizes, okay, I'm probably not going to be able to be steady with this guy for 3 rounds. I know the 3rd round's probably going to look ugly for me. So if I just really go for it early on, I do think Herbert Burns can have a really good chance. If he uses that burst, gets on top, uses great jiu-jitsu, he's just one of these fighters who it's almost like one punch, one kill power, but with his jiu-jitsu and not with his power. How many times do we talk about power punchers? It's, hey, if they land the shot, it's great, but if they don't land the shot, they get tired throwing a lot of those big shots. Gilbert Burns grapples in that same capacity. Herbert Burns, forgive me, grapples in that same capacity to where he's going to go for those really big actions, and it's great if he is able to snatch an arm, get into a really good position. But the problem is, there's a lot of space that is left on some of his transitions on the mat. And I do think that Bill Algeo, even though he has been susceptible to the takedown in the past, I think that he can scramble once he is on his back in this matchup. And that's going to be a really important thing to see if he can get back up to his feet based off of them.
Forget the opponent that I'm going to bring up, but just listen to me explain how Herbert Burns is able to get the win over Evan Dunham. But if you look at it, Burns slips out of the way of a punch into the back of Dunham, grabs it, jumps on top, gets the back, and he's a 3rd degree Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He is of that nth degree, and he's one of those guys that's going to snatch a neck, he's going to snatch an arm. He really is working to get the submission out of those positions. And when you do look at it for Algeo, obviously the biggest component of his game that is not that great, it is that takedown defense. But for Burns, Matt, I never look too hard into this stuff, but my God, when I went out and I watched his Instagram videos, what in the hell are you putting those out there for, Herbert? He's hitting combinations in the past with Sean Soriano, and I don't know who it's impressing. Maybe Gilbert, maybe his family.
I don't want to throw you under. I've never brought up an Instagram video ever on this channel.
It is 1-2s. They're slow as molasses. I don't know why we're doing it, because he's throwing out his nickname, The Blaze 420. But when you do look at it for Gilbert Burns, obviously his hands are probably the most lacking point of his game. And for Bill Algeo, so much quicker, so much more speedy. And when you compare his significant strike output level, 5.88 per minute, to the 3.38 average in the UFC, Algeo's en fuego. And then you consider how much he gets hit. I mean, it is at 4.43, so that's not that great, but it still is a positive differential. So for Algeo, Much better striker. For Algio, his last time out, it was a win over Joanderson Brito. That fight was about 5 months ago. For Herbert Burns, almost 2 years ago, since he did lose to Daniel Pineda, he could beat pillar to post and in positions on the ground as well against a smaller guy in Pineda.
Because I don't care how skilled you are. If you have bad cardio, your skills do fail once your cardio's gone, and that's the problem for Herbert Burns. This is my issue. He already has poor cardio, and he's going to have to waste even more energy going for takedown attempts against Bill Algio.
And he missed weight his last time out. That was a major component. He had a catchweight fight in the fight against Evan Dunham at 149, so 149.5 against Dunham, no issue. But he also weighed, as you can see on screen, 149.5 against Daniel Pineda. I think, like, what are we doing here? Like, at this point in his career, I think featherweight's a big stretch at 34.
I don't know if I've been making it very clear, but I think Herbert Burns is going to have an awful time this weekend in this matchup. You're fighting a rangy striker with great cardio, great output, who loves to go to the body. Every single time he goes to the body, he's just chipping away at Herbert Burns' gas tank even more and even more and even more. And that's the problem. Burns in that first round is going to be the better grappler, without a doubt, 1,000 times out of 1,000. In the second round, though, we've seen Herbert Burns get out-grappled when he does get tired. And I know Daniel Pineda is a good grappler in his own right. So just being beat by a guy like that on the mat isn't a death sentence for your MMA career. But I don't think he can stand Bill Algio's output, especially in the second and third round, because Herbert Burns defensively is okay. You throw a kick, I'm going to try to take you down off the kick. You throw a punch, I'm going to try to slip it, go for a big action. There's not a lot of foundational defensive striking in Herbert Burns' game plan, and that's why I think he's really going to struggle against Algio, who is much bigger, who is much rangier, and that's going to force Burns to shoot from even further away every single time, and those are just going to make the reads for Algio even easier. And I always go back to when Bill front kicked Ricardo Lamas in the face in the third round of their fight. Like, he didn't win the fight, but that was one of those losses where it's like, okay, you gain stock even in a loss. And I really do think that the best version of Senior Perfecto is better than the best version of Herbert Burns.
You look at the odds in this fight, they open with Burns plus 100, Algio minus 120. Algio's gained, he's minus 170. Burns at a plus 145. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Algio.
I'll say under.
It is under, so 346 total votes. This fight was added on short notice. 59% Algio, 84% by decision. For the 41% that have Burns, 59% by submission. Bill Algio doesn't have good takedown defense. Herbert Burns has good takedowns. Herbert Burns' striking is lacking. I know he has that flying knee knockout early in his UFC career. He also hasn't fought in 2 years. The weight cut's an issue for him. He's got Killcliff MMA behind him. Like, you can't have caffeine before a fight, but maybe they load him up with Killcliff. Like,
you can't. You just can't have two coffees. You can have one.
Well, Killcliff's an energy drink, but we'll see what happens. I do like Bill Algio with the output. Algio in his originally scheduled matchup against Quarantillo would have been fun. I think Quarantillo is a much more well-rounded fighter than Herbert Burns, so I probably would have picked, I would have picked Quarantillo to win that fight. And I actually would have had Burns to beat Ashkabob, because Ashkabob's never beaten anybody of substance. But in this matchup, I do like Algio with the output, with the length and the range, as long as he can figure out that distance early on. We saw what he did in his last fight against Joanderson Brito, a guy who has great takedowns in his own right and good jiu-jitsu.
And when I bring up his takedown defense, please hear me out. He's practiced for the same fighter in three straight camps. Like, yes, he lost to him the first time, beat him the second time, and I do think Algio's takedown defense overall did look improved his last time out against Brito. I just think stylistically, when you're constantly getting ready for a fighter who is somewhat limited on the feet, who has great ground skills, your camp's going to be very similar every single time getting ready for that opponent. So I do feel like as Algio's progressed throughout his MMA career, that's been the one area of his game that he has been able to improve. But again, against Herbert Burns, that is his clear path to victory. Like, if Burns decides, oh, I'm going to kickbox with Bill Algio for 15 minutes, it's going to be a terrible looking fight for him.
The 1-2s are coming from Herbert Burns, Matt. Both of us going with Bill Algio to get the win. Let us know down below if the bad takedown defense is enough and you're going with Herbert Burns, or if you have the King of Prussia's King of Prussia. We have a big time card, and if you like this fight at featherweight, oh my goodness, Charles Jourdain is taking on Shane Burgos. You're not going to want to miss that. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, a Bantamweight Showcase fight. And if Vic Mader and Sean Shelby said, let's get funky and let Craig and Matt Allen of Fight Night Picks make fights, we'd make fights like Ricky Simone versus Jack Short.
We'd put them on the main card, though, because that's where this fight belongs.
It, more so than Lauren Murphy and Misha Tate, but that's neither here nor there. When you look at this fight, Matt, I mean, for Ricky Simone, former LFA champ at Bantamweight, he spent time at featherweight at parts of his career. But you look at this guy. I mean, he's a guy out of Vancouver, Washington, adjacent to Portland, Oregon, trains out of ATT in Portland. He's a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt under Fabiano Scherner. And if you look at Simone, he wrestled in high school, had plans of wrestling in college, and then went, screw that, I'm going to become an MMA fighter. Pretty good decision by Ricky Simone. And you look at his overall career arc and the guys that he's trained with, like ATT Portland, Vince Morales, a main staple. And I know Morales has moved his camp since down to Syndicate, but both guys, they're cousins, they hang out, and Morales is helping Simone for this camp. And another guy that's at that camp and at that gym in Portland is a guy like Journey Newsome, who has nukes in his hands and jiu-jitsu that you never get to see, but it is very, very impressive. And for Ricky Simone, he's had a wild career. He's had great opportunities. He had a UFC debut victory over Merab Dvalishvili. But if you do look at it for Ricky Simone, and you consider the grapplers that are in this overall division, this is a point that I wanted to make. He is second all-time in bantamweight history with the most takedowns. 35 takedowns in his short UFC career. Merab Dvalishvili's number one was 50. But it's just incredible to see that out of Simone. And you look at the blip on the radar, the loss in his big marquee opportunity to Rob Font, the loss to Uriah Faber that he had. You might have thought, geez, this guy's never going to pan out. But for Ricky Simone, four-fight win streak, beats Ray Borg with his wrestling, goes out there and beats Gaetano Pirello and made it look easy because Gaetano Pirello was a not-ready-for-primetime player like on Saturday Night Live in the 90s. He beat Brian Kelleher and just beat him pillar to post. His hands looked crisp in that fight. And his last time out against Rafael dos Anjos, great head kicks and great boxing in that one too. Cutting very good angles, really doing a good job of cutting the cage. And when you watch Ricky Simone fights, great core movement and great head movement and a really hard guy to pin down and hit. Really good things that he's been able to add to his tool set as his career's gone on. Just the fact that he's not just a pure wrestler. He can mix everything together. And for Jack Shore, the hottest prospect out of Wales since his training partner, Brett Johns. But if you look at it for Shore, former Cage Warriors bantamweight champ, Brett Johns, third all-time UFC bantamweight history in takedown attempts. So that's pretty good. Takedowns landed. But for sure, since he won that title over with Cage Warriors, he had a performance of the night win in his UFC debut against Noeline Hernandez, but they stepped him up in competition. His last time out against Timur Valiev, dropped him a couple of times, got taken down by Valiev, but in that fight, listen, Mark Goddard probably could have ended that a couple of different times. For sure, really added everything together. Nice tall striker for this division. Crisp hands, doesn't really land a ton of volume, but the nice thing about Shore is he makes you think with the low kicks to mix in his level changes, loves to get the back, and out of his overall submission wins, Matt, 8 submission wins, 7 of them by rear naked choke, very much a position over submission guy, but he will grapple to take that back and choke you out. And Jack Shore, Ricky Simone, they're just both a pleasure to watch in the cage.
You've really broken most of the stuff down. I don't really know where to begin.
I watched a ton of tape for this one. So much tape.
So did I. This is the thing. I've been more impressed with Jack Shore as an MMA prospect. I will say that right now. Because for Ricky...
Is that just because of the Uriah Faber loss?
No, it's not. Ricky Simone, there's a double-edged sword for having great takedowns and having a volume of takedowns like Ricky Simone's. It means you need those takedowns to win your MMA fights no matter what the case is. And yes, his hands did look a lot better against Rafael dos Anjos his last time out, but dos Anjos wasn't really prime dos Anjos at that time. It's like when Joe Calzaghe beat Roy Jones Jr. near the end of his career. He beat him, but it wasn't Roy Jones Jr. It wasn't Superman from the early 2000s. And for Simone, I do think his striking did look like it took a level up in his last performance. But there is a little part of me in the back of my head that says, okay, well, it was over Rafael dos Anjos, who has taken a lot of damage throughout his career. And on the flip side, Jack Shore against Timur Valiev had a very, very tough fight until the last round of that fight. He was getting taken down. He looked tired, if we're being honest. But he found a way to fight through that adversity against a really good fighter, too. And that was really impressive. It's one of those performances that takes a guy from being a prospect and could make him a contender. But that's why this fight against Ricky Simone is so interesting, because we have seen Jack Shore get taken down, not get controlled up until this point. And that's where I do think Ricky Simone can have a lot of success. If he's able to get Jack Shore down, use some of his odd takedowns himself, go for some of those ankle picks, go for some of those high body takedowns. I do think he can give Jack Shore quite a bit of trouble with those. And this is something else that I've been thinking of too. In my mind's eye, I know on Tapology it has them at about the exact same size. I do think Ricky Simone is going to have somewhat of a physicality advantage in this matchup.
Yeah, that's a crazy thing. Like, I watch these Ricky Simone fights, and in Jack Shore's last fight against Timur Valiev, they bill Valiev as 5'6", but, like, he's not a big bantamweight. Like, he's just a bantamweight. When I look at Ricky Simone, The guy cuts weight, and you see the picture in front of you, like, he's muscled up, which his cardio doesn't really fall off a cliff as these fights go on. But Jack Shore, tall, long for the division as well.
But he does get stronger as these fights go on. I think that's going to be really interesting, because by the time the third round comes, will regular Ricky Simone be able to beat third round Jack Shore, who is going to go to the bottom of the tank, who is going to go for the finish? And that is the big difference between these guys. If there's a finish in this fight, I can almost guarantee I'm not going to Charles Barkley hit the red button, but it's more than likely going to be because Jack Shore is finishing Ricky Simone and not the other way around. Shore has shown a very good chin. He has phenomenal cardio, and he has really good submission defense too, to the point where I do favor him in a lot of these grappling sequences, because for Simone, I think he relies on his pure wrestling more than his grappling after the fact. When you do have those really high numbers, even think about Merab Dvalishvili. He gets you down, you kind of work your way back up to your base, and then he takes your soul and takes you down again. That's really disheartening for a lot of fighters to go through, because you get so close to getting back up to your feet, and then you're right back down, rinse and repeat. Jack Shore is not going to care about any of that, though. He's going to be able to have his own success in some of the grappling throughout this fight, and I think that's his small X factor that he can take advantage of. If he can make this a mixed martial arts fight and not just go in there wrestling with a guy like Ricky Simone, I think he can have a lot of success. The problem is, if he does get into one of those wrestling matches with a guy like Simone and he's not doing enough damage himself, I could see Simone just being able to control these three rounds enough with his own dominance and with his own physicality with the clinch up against the cage. Because if he is going to get Jack Shore up against the cage, I'm not sure if he'll be able to take him down from that position, but it's just going to be a time where Shore's not really doing anything himself.
And we saw Simone have a lot of success there against Brian Kelleher, and even in that Kelleher fight, you saw a little bit of a level up in the striking of Ricky Simone. Obviously, a great win over Sun Tzu. We all know Sun Tzu, you know, at one point, he was due some title shots. He wasn't able to cash that money in the bank. But for Simone, being able to beat a guy like that, it's impressive. You look at these guys, they're both takedown machines. Ricky Simone averages 6.76 per 15 minutes. For Jack Shore, 4.13. But he very much is a strike-to-grapple guy, where Ricky Simone is a strike a little bit to grapple a lot of it. So when I do look at this one, my big notes were, again, Shore stands a lot taller than Ricky Simone. Ricky Simone cuts more angles than Jack Shore. But for Shore, when you compare these two guys striking-wise, Ricky Simone, it's a lot of lead left hooks. He will throw the jab out there. Shore's going to throw a lot more leg kicks than Ricky Simone will. And for Simone, he throws a lot of lead left high kicks, which is kind of wild. They land, they give a different look to it, but he can kind of throw them because he hasn't really had to worry about the striking of his opponents in his last number of fights, so it just kind of opened up that extra level to his game. But for Jack Shore, very accurate down the pocket boxing, and he has gotten better at that one aspect as his career's gone on. 12-0 as an amateur, IMMAF European champion, 16-0 as a pro. He's never tasted defeat in MMA. Obviously, for Ricky Simone, came in on season one of Dana White's Contender Series 2017, won a split decision. They said, go get some leveling up. He was able to get that done over with LFA, winning the belts, beating Merab, and the rest is history. We have a look at the odds in this fight. They opened very closely. Shore minus 115, Simone minus 105. Now Shore is a bigger favorite. Minus 162 is the average on best fight odds for Simone, plus 133. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt, surprise to us, they are to you. Jack Shore is a super prospect. He doesn't have any losses, and the fans at Fight Night Picks love him. So I'm going to say over under 70% Shore.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. 74% Jack Shore on 708 total votes, 83% by decision. For the 26% that have Ricky Simone, 83% by decision. So the fans are expecting a decision over on Tapology. I also expect a decision. It's hard to beat Ricky Simone by finish. Old man Uriah Faber did it. That was kind of a weird one. And for Jack Shore, we've seen him take into the deep waters against some wrestlers. Obviously, he had that fight against pure American wrestler Hunter Azure, former UFC's own. But since then, yeah, it's been a mixed bag, and we've seen some growth from Shore as well. So I can't wait for this fight. It's one of my top fights on this card. What's the pick here?
It is an interesting fight, because I think Jack Shore is going to have a really hard time getting off his own offense with an opponent like Ricky Simone, who can just go chest-to-chest with you, and that negates a lot of your own offense. The problem is, for some reason, I was thinking about mouse traps while you were talking, and there's, like, the regular old ones that just have, like, the wire, right? And then I remember going to my grandparents, they'd have, like, the really mean ones that look like a T-Rex mouth. Jack Shore is the T-Rex version of what Ricky Simone is as a regular mouse trap. Like, they do a lot of the same things well. The difference is, Shore has a lot more power behind his shots. He does have more of a submission mind when he comes to his own grappling. So for those reasons, I do think he's more likely to damage Ricky Simone. But I will say this, Ricky Simone could out-control Jack Shore, so that does leave an opportunity for him to win a decision, but I'm still going to go with the guy who I think could do the most damage in the fight.
You look at Jack Shore in his last fight, he had the two knockdowns against Timur Valiyev. He got out-wrestled at the start of the first round, or sorry, the end of the first round. Valiyev just kind of got close to him and like almost pushed him over and landed on top. And then as the fight went on, he kept going for takedowns. He was successful with one more. But for sure, we obviously saw him damaging Valiyev. I think Valiyev's a good fighter, but he's been hot and cold in the UFC. I don't know if we got PFL-level Valiyev in the UFC. I know he had that great fight against Barcelos. I like the level up from Ricky Simon. I like the fact that he cuts angles, he cuts the cage, he utilizes offensive wrestling. He can dictate the pace with which he can control these takedowns, and I think he's going to push Jack Shore up behind the black line. I'm eager to see if Shore can strike off the back foot in this fight, because I think that's going to be a big key. But I do have Simon here. I think it's going to be a great fight, though.
I think it will be, but again, Ricky Simon has to do something on the feet to get that respect to move his opponent backwards. I don't think Jack Shore is going to be afraid to move backwards with a guy like Ricky Simon, who isn't really known for his own power in his hands. And I really do think that your opponent has to respect you for them to just be willing to give up all that space. So I think Jack Shore is going to be the one moving forward. I know at some points he's going to have to defend some takedowns, but I do really like his grappling once it does hit the mat. I know sometimes he can be defensive, but the second he gets on top of his opponent, he can really hurt his opponent, whereas he's so good defensively off of his back that normally it can't be said the same the other way. So I do like Jack Shore in this fight, but this is the most important fight of his career by far. Timur Valiyev is a good win to get people convinced that you could be one of those uber prospects, but Ricky Simon gets you into the rankings, and it's one of those opponents who, okay, you beat Ricky Simon, well, you're never getting an easy fight from here on out. So Shore better be ready, and he better be sure that he has taken that big level up before he does beat a guy like Ricky Simon, because it's going to be tough fight after tough fight from this point on.
Ricky Simon, your 11th ranked bantamweight. I have him to get the win. Matt going with the 14th ranked favorite, who is Jack Shore. His nickname is Tank, and a great opportunity to get a win coming up this weekend. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Big time fight card coming up this weekend, including a featherweight marquee matchup between Brian Ortega and Yair Rodriguez that you're not going to want to miss. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, middleweight grapplers who tend to strike square off on respective two-fight losing streaks. We have a big-time favorite in Puna Soriano taking on Dolce champion Lin Jambula. And Matt, we talk about this almost every weekend. For Dolce champion, I mean, 2017, 2018, he was getting wins over guys like Andrew Van Zyl, a win over Stuart Austin, a guy who's just had his face beat in over at the PFL the last 2 years. But when you look at a guy like Dolce, like, is he like your Robbie Lawler? Is he forever champion, the former light heavyweight and heavyweight champ over at the FC? Or do you have to change the nickname up at a certain point?
I hope you never compare Dolce to Robbie Lawler ever again. Robbie Lawler's one of the great champs of all time. For Dolce, I'm not a big fan of it. If you're a champ in the UFC, I'm okay with it. And I'm not one of these, like, UFC over everything. But the thing is, the best talent does naturally kind of reside in this organization. And if Dolce was champ, he'd probably at least be able to get into the rankings at this point.
Well, you look at it for Dolce. He debuts in the UFC at 205, beats Daquan Townsend, knocks him out, goes out there and gets completely outclassed and knocked out by Magomed Ankalaev with a crazy kick. He beats Marcus Perez his next time out. And then he's lost his last two fights. And I mean, his last fight, obviously, apparently Cody Brundage has knockout power and submission powers in the first round. But Dolce Lin Jambula at multiple points in the first round of his last fight against Cody Brundage. I was surprised it wasn't stopped. He beat and beat and beat and beat him down until Brundage just kind of squared him up against the cage, wrapped up the neck, and got a very tight guillotine. So good win for Brundage. Obviously disheartening for Lin Jambula. And since he's been with the UFC, it's been an odd one because for Dolce, he was on the 2007 to 2009 Congolese national judo team, black belt in judo. It's a highlight of his game, and he's got those crazy, powerful upper body takedowns, but he has struggled against some wrestlers, and they're just, you know, I say simple. It's not simple, but you're more common North American single legs and double legs. And for Puna Soriano, this guy, D3 All-American at Wartburg College in Iowa, and that's a staple of his game when he does go for it. Now, for Puna, his last time out, split decision loss to Nick Maximov. Puna outstruck him. Nick just went for those chain takedowns, and Nick goes for
thought he didn't have that.
And Puna couldn't really stop the takedown. So you look at it that time, his other loss, because he's only ever lost two fights as a pro, and they're back to back now, so it's a losing streak. But to Brendan Allen, He got outstruck and he got outboxed by Brendan Allen, and he was constantly chasing in that fight.
And it was a weird performance because Brendan Allen at that time wasn't really known as having this like back pocket Sanford slash kill clip MMA striking, but he did look really good in that fight, and that was the fight that you go, okay, maybe Brendan Allen has leveled up his striking. It was weird though to see such a power oriented striker like Punahele Soriano be so willing to back up against a guy who isn't really known for his own knockout power and who wasn't throwing a crazy amount of volume at him. And that's the one thing about this fight that I'm a little concerned about. I can see this fight being awful until it isn't, and a lot of people don't like it when you hear that, but hear me out. Dolcilin Jambula likes to move forward, he has a very straight jab, he's someone who will throw a lot of power shots, but they're not the fastest punches in the world, and you can see them coming, especially if he loads up on them. He's not a guy who he loads up and he'll miss a shot and you go, oh my god, if he made or if he landed on that, he definitely would have knocked him out. He'll miss on some of these big looping overheads and you go like, oh my goodness. Like if he was in there with a really talented championship quality fighter, they could take advantage of some of those holes in his striking. But that's the weird thing about Dolce. I always go back to the Marcus Perez fight and I go, okay, well, Dolce doesn't have great offensive takedowns for the most part. He likes to go a lot more with his hands. He doesn't have great cardio. And then all of a sudden in the third round against Perez, he looked really good on the mat. And that's something that's always in the back of my mind. It's like, hey, he doesn't have good cardio. But remember that one time he did have really good cardio? So I just never know at what weight class or what situation is really best for Dolce.
Well, that's it. I mean, you look at Dolce and he wins that fight against Marcus Perez. And he trained at Killcliff MMA, formerly Sanford, for a while. Then he mixed it up and he went to Extreme Couture. So these guys would have trained at some point together last year because Dolce made the move over there. He was training with Black Cobra Striking Systems' own, a guy who hates right-handed sleeves. Oh! Not Hacksaw Jim Duggan. It's my guy, Dewey Cooper. But for Dolce, good striking coach. Didn't really make a bit of difference. Like I look
That's
at
a good point, actually.
The good thing I like out of Dolce is that he's training with Brendan Allen and Marc-Andre Barrio to get ready for this fight against Puna Soriano. Guys who have had eyes on Soriano. Obviously, Barrio won the fight against Lin Jambula, but for Barrio, we go chest to chest. I work takedowns and I strike, and push you up behind the black line. Dolce's not able to have that full extension overhand, right? Like when he knocked out Alain Badeau over with EFC. But when you look at Dolce, does have a steady jab. There's a lot of power behind it because he puts a lot of force on his lead leg when he does throw it. But the trouble is, he has decent volume. It's just slightly below UFC average. But when he lands, it matters. We just haven't really seen him land a lot in the UFC. I mean, Daquan Townsend's a good example, but poor Daquan had a rough run in the UFC. And for Puna, like, he had the great win streak. He beat a guy like Dusko Todorovic. That's pretty good. He beat Jamie Pickett on Dana White's Contender Series, knocked out Oscar Piotta.
That was a nice one.
But I started this video off for a reason the way that I did. Puna Soriano opened a minus 275. He's still a minus 275. Dolcilin Jambula plus 225. Puna Soriano's not much more of a volume-oriented striker than Dolce is, and he's not giant on his offensive takedowns. He is, and they work, but when they don't, I mean, like, these guys cancel each other out. I see this as a really close fight, so the odds really did surprise me when I wrote them down just before this video.
I agree 100%. I was very surprised to see where the odds ended up being or where they are right now. I'm sure they'll shift as we get closer to the fight, but still, the fact that Punahele is such a big favorite is quite surprising. The only thing that I do think he has an X factor in, I do think his hand speed is much faster than Dolce's if he is able to get into the pocket. Now, is getting into the pocket with Dolcilin Jambula the greatest idea of all time? Probably not. I know I'd be terrified to do it.
Would you like to go in a pit full of alligators too?
Probably not, exactly. They seem as welcoming of situations. But for Soriano, I really do think that his kind of peekaboo style with his boxing, he does almost fight like a Rampage Jackson. When he did come over to the UFC after Pride, he's someone who will employ a high guard when he does throw his own strikes. And I do think that when you're fighting a guy like Dolce, who is a headhunter at his core, he does not go to the body with his jab. He doesn't really throw much for kicks. He will every now and then to switch it up, but it's like single percentage type stuff with his kicks. I just don't know what Dolce is going to do as a plan B. But if you're Soriano, I do think his plan B could get a takedown offensively. I do think his forward pressure could be enough to at least freeze Dolce so he doesn't know what to do. Okay, am I in takedown defense mode or am I in striking defense mode? And I think those in-betweens where Soriano can maybe outthink Dolce on some of those points is where he could find the most success. But again, where Punahele is going to have his most success is probably going to be the most dangerous area of this fight.
I like the lead right hook of Puna Soriano from a southpaw, and obviously being a southpaw creates a different wrinkle in a fight like this. But again, I mentioned the odds. I think this one's close. So when they're close fights like that, usually you go with an underdog. It's plus 225. But we'll have a look at the fan vote over on Tapology. Surprise to us, there to you. Again, when a guy's that big of a favorite, I have to think that the fans are siding with him as well. So I'll say over under 72.5% Soriano.
Way below.
Way below. Way above. Wow. 672 total votes. 90% Soriano. 20% by decision. 73% by knockout. For the 10% that have Lunjambula. 57% by KO or TKO. Dolce, again, upper body throws could be good. Puna can push a pace, so maybe up against the cage, Dolce is able to reverse the position and just go off. And we saw him have a lot of success against a wrestler in Cody Brunge's last time out. Until he gets submitted, I like Soriano ever so slightly, but again, this is the one that ruins your parlay right here.
Yeah, don't waste your money on this fight, but if you're just doing it to get a prediction right or wrong, I do think Punahele Soriano is the more skilled fighter.
Both of us going with Puna Soriano. It's scary. Don't bet on it. Just watch it. Popping popcorn, Matt. Big time fight in this middleweight division. Ever dynamic these days. It's a lot of fun. We get a big time fight in the featherweight division in the main event. Brian Ortega, T-City, taking on Yair Rodriguez. Should be a great one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Coming up this weekend, an interesting fight at flyweight between the former bantamweight champion Cupcake Miesha Tate taking on the recent title challenger for the flyweight strap, Lucky Lauren Murphy, our Fight Night Picks 2020 Female Fighter of the Year. She went 3-0. It was an amazing run, and she capped that year off with a finish win over USADA's darling, Lilia Shakarova, and then a split decision win over perennial number one contender, but not anymore, Joanne Wood. But if you look at it for Lauren Murphy, she's weeks away from her 39th birthday. And for Miesha Tate, she's a month away from her 36th birthday. And this has been a weird career arc for Miesha Tate because she won the belt, she beat Holly Holm, she loses the belt to Amanda Nunes, she loses to Raquel Pennington, and then she takes like 4.5 years off. She becomes the ONE Championship vice president.
You're missing out on a bit though. She was like the Junior Dos Santos of this division when Ronda Rousey was on top. Like
the bantamweight division.
Yeah, but JDS could beat everybody not named Cain Velasquez. Miesha Tate was like that, but with Ronda Rousey. Like, there is no women's MMA without Miesha Tate.
In Strikeforce and in the UFC to Ronda Rousey. But if you look at it for Miesha Tate, that long gap away, I mean, even in 2022, she won Celebrity Big Brother, so that's interesting, and it's never good.
I've never watched Big Brother.
Neither have I, and it's never great when you're talking about accomplishments outside of the UFC, but you're still fighting and you're almost 36, but regardless, for Tate, she beat Marion Renault and she looked good. And then she fought Catlin Vieira and couldn't close the distance. She did rally in round, three and round four, yep. But she lost round five. She definitely lost the first two rounds. But for Tate, that was a problem. Like, Vieira's a taller, bigger, longer fighter at bantamweight. She just kept her head back, stayed on her bike, and just landed one, two from the outside. And Tate could never close it. Now, Tate did land a couple of good right hands when she actually stepped into her shots. But for the most part, Tate was ducking back and trying to land her punches, and she hit air a lot in that fight.
I could not agree more. That's the thing about Miesha Tate. We all know what her bread and butter is. She's a phenomenal wrestler. She has, like, that pit bull on a bone mentality of, hey, I'm not going to let go the second I can get to it. And it has really worked out for her in the past. The problem is with Miesha Tate, she has looked good on the feet in some spots, but the weird thing is she could never really get sustained levels of success going on the feet. But I will say this, the fight against Catlin Vieira is a very different fight than the one with Lauren Murphy, because when you're Miesha Tate, okay, I'm this great wrestler, I have decent submissions, but you're probably not going to out-grapple Catlin Vieira on the mat, so I just think stylistically that was an opponent who almost cut out half of Miesha Tate's skill set when she walked into the ring, and that's why I think this fight against Lauren Murphy is a great reset for her at 125 pounds, because A, it's a new weight class with a former champion who does have a big name. Let's not get it twisted. Miesha Tate's still one of the most popular women's MMA fighters on the planet, and if she is able to get a win over Lauren Murphy, I don't think a Miesha Tate versus Valentina Shevchenko fight is all that exciting, to be honest, but that is a fight that the UFC is going to put as the co-main event of a pay-per-view. It's a fight that they're going to sell and sell and sell because Miesha Tate fought Ronda Rousey and she fought Amanda Nunes. I just think this stylistically does favor Miesha Tate. She's fighting someone who doesn't have incredible power on the feet, but does have very good boxing, doesn't have great takedown defense, and is a little bit smaller. The difference is, Lauren Murphy has looked better at this stage of her career, so it is almost counterintuitive to say the things that I just said. The difference is, Tate was fighting, I would argue, better fighters in a deeper weight class.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it for Lauren Murphy, she had the Jessica Eye run at bantamweight, but she didn't have the Jessica Eye run at flyweight. Lauren Murphy ran it down to 125, competed on the Ultimate Fighter, lost Nico Montano, said screw that noise, and then just started winning. So that was the best part for Lauren Murphy. You look at the wins before she fought for the title, and again, I mentioned the 3-fight win streak in 2020. Wins over Andrea Lee by split decision, one over Roxanne Modafferi, one over Shakarova on short notice, and then the fight against Joanne Wood. She fights for the title. She gets finished in the fourth round. She didn't have much success in that fight. She's a plus 850 underdog. This fight between Tate and Murphy was originally supposed to take place at UFC 276. Murphy off the card due to the COVID, but I've seen her in the gym. I've seen her training since. The interesting thing for Murphy, she's trained a lot in Texas. She's a Texas-based fighter, and I know she's trained at the lab in the past, but she really is. Kruba Perez is in the corner. Her husband's in the corner as well. She's been training at pound for pound fitness with, you know, that's Tisha Torres' gym. Justin Houghton is the head coach there. He's a kickboxing whiz, and he really has whipped a lot of fighters into shape. But she's mainly training with Miranda Maverick for this camp before the COVID, after the COVID. And I like that as a training partner to get ready for Tate. The flip side, Tate, she's going to turn 36 shortly. 15-year MMA career. This is going to be her 28th pro fight. She's never fought at flyweight, and it's a second cut to get ready to go down to 125 in as many weeks. I assume she's gotten her body ready for the cut. But it's just interesting, because years ago, I never would have thought, Misha Tate, 125. Let's give her a go.
I could not agree more. We were talking right before we got filmed. I do think Tate did look better physically when she did make her re-entry into the UFC. She looked very lean on the scales for her first fight back, so maybe she does think, okay, I can't compete with these women at 135 anymore. 125 is more of my natural weight class, but you're right. It's never promising to see a fighter past the age of 35 decide, okay, this is now my new weight class, because there is a lot that goes into switching weight classes and cutting weight general. I always go back to what Michael Chandler said. I forget what fighter missed weight, but it was a lightweight fighter who missed weight. And Michael Chandler was like, hey, the weight cut doesn't start the week of the fight. The weight cut starts 2 months out. Like, you have to get your nutrition right. You have to make sure you burn the right amount of calories. You have to count your macros. Like, it's a lot of work that goes into all of this. So for Misha Tate, I do think that she would not have made this move down if she wasn't going to do it in the smartest way possible. And I do think that stylistically, this is a very favorable matchup for Misha Tate. Lauren Murphy is one of the few fighters older than Misha Tate who she could fight ahead of her in the rankings. And I don't say that to be dismissive of Lauren Murphy, but it's the truth. Normally, Misha Tate would be the longtime veteran compared to anybody who she's fighting. This is one of the rare opportunities where she is probably closer to her prime than Lauren Murphy is. And I only say that because I think Misha Tate's much more physically strong than Lauren Murphy, especially at this weight class. Now, the weight cut is going to matter quite a bit, so maybe my opinion will shift by the time we get to this weekend. But if plan A for Misha Tate is to wrestle, and plan A for Lauren Murphy is to box, what the heck is Lauren Murphy going to do to get separation from Misha Tate? I just don't know what her plan B is going to be. I think she has good clinch control, but she's not great at breaking out of the clinch and getting separation again. And that's where Misha Tate's going to go for a lot of her own takedowns.
That's my trouble when I was doing the analysis for this fight and watching the tape. Misha Tate, before the layoff, before the losses, it was wrestling, it was pressure, it was clinch control, cage control, and getting you down in the mat and having a low amount of volume on the feet. And then her two fights back, she has high volume against Marion Renault, and she looks great with her striking. She has high volume against Ketlin Vieira.
If I may, though, those are two of the most dangerous grapplers in the division. So if you're not going to wrestle with anybody, like Marion Renault submitted Sarah McMahon off of her back. Like, those are legitimate submission threats. So I really do believe that it was more opponent-based than her own style.
It's just, it's weird to see that and then go into a matchup against Lauren Murphy down 10 pounds where you've never been and then get into that same kind of fight that you were known for. And a perennial staple of Extreme Couture is Misha Tate, unless one championship had you believe that she was ever going to fight out of Evolve, which is the silliest friggin' thing I've ever seen. Singapore zone. So I look at the odds in this fight. Lauren Murphy, the former title challenger, open plus 135, plus 140 roughly there. Misha Tate open minus 162, they say, on best fight odds. Minus 175 or thereabouts right now. We have a look at the total votes on Topology. I doubt they're close. I'm going to say over under 80% Misha Tate.
I'll say under just because that's pretty high.
Oh, look at that. 584 total votes. 64% Tate, 88% by decision. For the 36% that have Lauren Murphy, 90% by decision. I assume that fight goes the distance is like minus 500 in this one. So again, Murphy, Tate. Murphy historically has better, volume. But we see nice volume in these last two Misha Tate fights. I have Misha Tate by a slim margin, but make your own approximations in this fight. Because Murphy, with that camp out of Colorado, getting ready for this matchup, facing off with a lot of primary grapplers. I would assume Raquel Pennington's like that secret Swiss Army knife in the back pocket. Somebody who's beaten Misha Tate. getting had success against her on the ground as well. I would think that's a great person to have in your camp. But Lauren Murphy isn't Raquel Pennington, so I do have Tate here. But I think this is going to be a greasy fight that ends in a controversial decision.
I think the Pennington point is a very good one to bring up. But that's the thing with Lauren Murphy. She's going to be defending a lot in this fight. And it's hard to get your own offense on when you're always on the defensive. She's either going to be defending takedowns or trying to put up with the volume striking of Miesha Tate. And I think Tate, down at 125 in only a three-round fight, like, this is probably the most comfortable setting Miesha Tate will get for the rest of her career. Like, everything's kind of been catered towards her for this fight, at least. But again, I'm very concerned to see what she looks like at 125. Personally, I do think she will look good on the scales, but again, just because I said it doesn't mean I'm right. So I am very curious to see how Tate looks by the time they get to the scales, but I do agree with you. Right now, I have Miesha Tate.
Red flags are there. Both of us going with the former champ, Cupcake. Miesha Tate struggled with that sentence. Cupcake Miesha Tate. There we go. Taking on Lucky Lauren Murphy. Let us know in the comment section who you have. I'm really interested to get everybody's opinion. And you folks have been sharing some great ones down there. So keep them coming. We had a big time marquee matchup jumpings at featherweight between Brian Ortega and El Pantera Yair Rodriguez in that main event. I can't wait for it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it.
That's a lot of damage.
Coming up this weekend, a fight that could be on the main card of a pay-per-view. It feels like a video game fight. We have Hurricane Shane Burgos taking on Belay Quebec Canada's own Air Charles Jourdain. Matt, I love this fight. You have the hometown guy representing New York in Shane Burgos. Big time opportunity to take on the Canadian striker of Charles Jourdain. And for both of these guys, incredible success in the UFC's octagon. This is Jourdain's first ranked opponent in the UFC. And for Hurricane Shane, I mean, he went on a 2-fight losing streak. You had to be doing a little bit of soul searching. Like, you look at the losses, Josh Emmett, Edson Barboza, and man,
so much damage.
Phil Swift would have a field day with that. But if you look at it, for Burgos, his last time out, he gets a big time win over Billy Quarantillo, one that kind of levels the boat back out on stormy seas. And for Burgos, I mean, I look at what this guy's been able to dish out and then receive in the UFC, and it's been absolutely insane. You look at it so far, and of the knockdowns, he's been dropped by Calvin Kattar, Josh Emmett, Edson Barboza, and Kurt Holaba.
He did submit him, though, immediately after.
Did submit him in that one. He also has knockdowns of his own. He has 6 of them. Charles Jourdain also has 6 knockdowns in his UFC career. And that's just been the craziest part. For Jourdain, comes in, short notice debut, up a weight class against Desmond Green. He gets out-wrestled and out-veteraned in that fight. A lot of ringmanship in that one. His next time out, performance bonus in Busan, South Korea, hometown of one Doo Ho Choi, Charles Jourdain got the bag and finished him in that one. Obviously, again, performance bonus. But Matt, for Jourdain, this is a guy out of Quebec, and we love Quebec here. Like, I've got a Molson export. The last time I cracked a top on a Molson on this channel, Matt, for a fellow Canadian, we both have Molsons. Matt's got Molson Canadian export. But the last time we did this, it was when Tanner Boser fought Andre Arlovsky.
How did that fight end?
And Tanner Boser lost. So this is a bad omen for Charles Jourdain on the channel.
Okay, I'm going to make this a much more open-ended prediction and bounce stuff off of you. Way more than I normally do. Because there's two different ways that I'm looking at this fight. In one way, Shane Burgos does everything Charles Jourdain done. But he's a little bit more refined with his technique. He doesn't really throw the body kicks. But other than that, both very strike-heavy fighters. They both want to move forward. Eat a shot to give a shot. You get the idea. I didn't think Shane Burgos looked good in his Billy Q win, though. And that's just me being honest. I knew a lot of people at that time who were like, hey, did Quarantillo win that fight? And I don't know what the MMA decisions are. I don't care about that website at all, for being honest. But I do know that was a very, very competitive fight. And that was concerning because from the pedestal that Burgos was on at the time, you would think, okay, he lost to Josh Emmett in what was a very close fight until Josh Emmett blew out his knee and then also dropped Burgos with some of the hardest punches you've ever seen. And he was competitive with Edson until it started to fall apart. But I wasn't thrilled with the performance he put out against Billy Q because I felt like Billy Q was able to outpower him in some of those situations. And that's definitely not how I thought that fight was going to go. Burgos was the one who was kind of playing the pitter-patter, trying to use his movement. And Billy Q was happy to just walk forward, eat punches, and then respond with his own power. So in my mind right now, it's okay. The Shane Burgos we even fought, like, Calvin Kattar. I know that was a few years ago. But that guy would probably be able to knock out Billy Q if he's able to land the same kind of strikes on him. He just didn't seem like he still had that power in his hands. And I'm a little bit concerned because if Burgos isn't at 100%, like 100% Shane Burgos is probably, let's say, 7% better than Charles Jourdain. There's not a lot of room for error being left right there, though, and I do worry about what version of Shane Burgos we're going to get. Like, do you think he is starting to fade because of some of these wars? Because there is a part of me that thinks the tread is starting to wear down on the tire.
I mean, you look at that fight for Shane Burgos, and we consider the losses. So his fight against Josh Emmett was 2 years ago. His fight against Edson Barboza, he took a year off, so that was a year ago. His fight against Billy Q, 7 months and 2 weeks ago. So refining things, sharpening the sword at Tiger Showman's. When you watch Shane Burgos, like, he has submission wins over Bill Algeo. He's got a submission win over Kurt Hollibaugh in the UFC. That definitely holds water. But you look at Shane Burgos boxing. Boxing combinations, crisp striking, long extension. You look at it in this fight. He's got, what, 6.5 inches of reach, and he's got 2 inches of height.
He has a wild build to him.
Yeah, and he's a guy that's very upper body heavy, and he doesn't use a lot of kicks, which is the opposite of Charles Jourdain. When you look at Charles Jourdain, he will switch stances, but when you look at him from southpaw, he throws a lead right hook, he throws kicks to all three levels, which we don't see very often. Like, you see somebody that goes to the legs, that's great. You see somebody like Antonina Shevchenko, southpaw last weekend, that only throws, like, axe kicks and modified head kicks to the head.
That's the way I always think about it. Normally you have kickers who focus on the first two things they can hit, be it top or bottom. They'll do leg and body, or they'll do head and body. Not a lot of people do leg kicks and head kicks and no body attack.
Yeah, but for Jourdain, all three. Exactly. So he lands all three. He'll switch it over to orthodox and he'll box a little bit. He'll throw a jab with his left. He'll throw a right cross. But by and large, Jourdain very much is a well-refined striker, but I would say kickboxer, not necessarily boxer. So that's where the interesting clash of strikers comes up in this one.
And this is the other question I was going to ask you. Do you think this could be one of the situations where we see Jourdain only fight out of the southpaw position? Because that body kick is going to be a big factor. And I know Jourdain is a good boxer, but I do not think he can box from the orthodox position to the level of a guy like Shane Burgos. Because again, the only people who have been able to outstrike Shane Burgos is Josh Emmett, who might be the most heavy-handed man in the UFC, regardless of weight class, and Edson Barboza, and what was one of the great fights of all time, before he got dropped by what was a very concerning, for being honest, overhand right from Edson. And that was kind of the moment where I was like, okay, is Shane Burgos taking too much damage? And I do
that
think,
was it?
Well, I know that's the wild thing, that it took that long, but it is true. Like, when you go back and look at Shane Burgos's fights, even the ones that he wins, he's taking a lot of punishment in. So there's a world out there where I look at it as, okay, Burgos might be his most refined skill set. Like, he won't get any better, he won't get any worse. But Charles Jourdain might not have as much wear and tear on him at this point. So let's say both these guys do decide, okay, we're getting into a war, like one of those stand down Max Holloway, Ricardo Lamas type fights. If Shane Burgos is not at 100% of his durability, that's where Jourdain could land one of those body kicks, fall down, and he likes to plant off his left leg after he throws that body kick and wing it overhand left. If he hits Shane Burgos with one of those types of shots, I do think Jourdain has enough power to put him down and away.
And for Jourdain, we've seen these fights where, like the Joshua Culibao fight, where he really couldn't figure it out. Like, he almost got the finish, then he didn't, then he almost got finished himself. He comes back, he wins the fight against Marcelo Rojo, and the two fights that I want to point out, then he loses to Julian Rose and gets finished. That was only two fights ago. Almost 6 months ago, he beats Andre Ewell. The fight against Marcelo Rojo and the fight against Andre Ewell, Charles Jourdain looked like a guy that would give rank fighters problems. That's why he's in this fight.
I would agree 100%.
But in some other fights, the volume isn't quite there. The aggression isn't quite there. He just can't really figure it out. I think he's leveled up the last two fights. Obviously, we talk a lot about Charles Jourdain, not just in Jourdain fights. He's one of our guys like Douglas Silva de Andrade, or pick your other fighter. But we use him a lot as an example in these fights.
That's the thing, not to cut you off, but a lot of people like to ask, okay, who are your favorite fighters? What are fighters you don't like? I don't have a personal feeling on any single fighter. I just like them if they're entertaining, and I probably don't like them if they're not entertaining. So by that measurement, you can understand why we are so excited for this fight.
So both of these guys, different strikers, but they bring obviously different things to the cage. Burgos fights at a higher pace typically, but this is the craziest thing. Burgos has a significant strike differential of 1.27, Jourdain 1.07, so not that different. This is where the numbers actually play in, and these guys have enough accumulated time in the octagon that I actually do figure these in. 7.95 to 6.69 received for Burgos, the strikes landed to receive per minute significantly. And if you look at it for Jourdain, 5.60 to 4.53, so crazy volume given and taken for both these guys. Very, very entertaining. We look at the odds. Burgos open -150, -195 for Jourdain, open +130, +160. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us there, to you, Matt. Well, Canada and Quebec represent. I'm going to say over under 70% Burgos.
I'm going to say under. I think it'll be more 50-50.
I think it's going to be 50-50. Oh, just under. 678 total votes, 69% Burgos, 77% by decision, 14% by knockout. For the 31% that have Jourdain, 59% by decision, 29% by knockout. Not a lot of people factoring in the submission. Jourdain gutted his last time out. He's struggling with the takedowns against Lando Venata, and then he just synced that submission up quite nicely. So that added component out of Jourdain, a guy who was from Beloit originally, trains at a Brazilian top team in Montreal, as well as Sherbatov Gym with Ultimate Fighter alum Yoni Sherbatov over by Le Carrefour de Laval in Laval. And if you're a Canadian that grew up and went to middle school, obviously it was a big
space
opportunity to go to space camp. That's just around the block from Sherbatov
Gym.
That
was so much fun.
That was the greatest time. And Matt, I wasn't drinking Molson Exports back then, but if I was, I'd be pretty metal. I don't endorse that at all. Don't underage drink. But Matt, in this fight, we have...
this went all sorts of ways.
We have Charles Jourdain with such a varied striking array, and we have Shane Burgos with the upper volume in the boxing. What's the pick here?
I don't think the best version of Shane Burgos is going to lose to Charles Jourdain. I just don't know what version of Shane Burgos we're going to get. And I know I brought that up a lot during this episode, but it really is the truth. When you've seen a guy go through the amount of wars that Shane Burgos has, you do leave a part of you in there. I know that's a very cliche thing to say, but that's something they say in every single time there's a really wild boxing fight is, hey, they did leave a part of themselves in there, and they're not going to be the same fighter afterwards. There's about seven fights to Shane Burgos that you could apply that mentality to, and for Jourdain, he is cut from that same cloth, but at least he is a little bit younger in his career to where I don't think he has taken the same level of damage. Now, based off what I just said, you're probably thinking Matt's going to pick Charles Jourdain, but I do think that the boxing of Shane Burgos is going to be such a unique challenge for Jourdain. I think that Jourdain is going to have to fight out of that southpaw position a lot more than just switching between the two, because offensively, I do think his southpaw position is much better than his orthodox position, and I'm kind of surprised that he does switch hit as much as he does and not just stick to the one spot. I like the kicks from Jourdain, but I do think that the overwhelming boxing pressure of Shane Burgos is really going to get to Jourdain, because again, that wasn't that long ago that Jourdain got tired fighting Julian Arosa, and I know, I do think he learned from that performance, but still, that wasn't that long ago, and when you look at the guys Jourdain has beat lately, Shane Burgos would definitely beat them. When you look at the guys Shane Burgos has lost to lately, well, Edson Barbosa and Josh Emmett probably both beat Charles Jourdain too, so I think this fight is very fun, it's very well matched, but ever so slightly going to take the favorite in Shane Burgos.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I obviously worry about Shane Burgos' chin, and you watch these two guys fight. When Burgos throws in combination, he'll rip the body and then go to the head. For Charles Jourdain, he'll do the same, but from distance, he'll start with a kick, and then once you bring your defenses down, then he gets to open up with his hand. So for Jourdain, a great opportunity against a ranked opponent, but for me, I like Shane Burgos with the boxing, the combinations, the speed, and the power. We just get to gauge where Burgos is at and if Jourdain can beat that ranked competition to move forward through his career. So great opportunity for both guys. We're going against the Canadian here. Both of us going with New York's own Shane Burgos to get the win. Are we traitors? I mean, I'm wearing a Rough Rider shirt, for goodness sake. And Matt, you're wearing a Mickey Ward shirt.
Yeah, so shout out to the OG.
That one doesn't play. But both of us going with Burgos. Let us know in the comment section who you have in this matchup. This is a marquee featherweight fight, but the main event plateaus that. We have Brian Ortega taking on Yair Rodriguez. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Interesting fight coming up this weekend at flyweight. It feels like laying down the Mirror Force card. Remember when you played that game when you were a kid? Yu-Gi-Oh!
It feels like the owner just passed away, actually. That's sad stuff.
So rest in peace. But it does feel like a trap card type of fight. We have Danger, Matt Schnell, taking on the Tibetan Eagle, Sumedergi. A guy who came into the UFC off a loss with WLF Wars. And if I've ever seen a red flag, that is it. He loses to Luis Smolka, a giant red flag, and since then, he's gone on a win streak, and for Sumedergi, a guy who had so many early wins in his MMA career, it wasn't really likely that we'd be on this path, but he landed great volume of straight shots against Andrei Sukumtov, knocked out Malcolm Gordon with those same straight shots, and then he gets a win over Zaruk Adashev with more volume striking, some back foot striking in that matchup. Now, that fight against Zaruk Adashev was a year and a half ago. But for Sumedergi, he was supposed to take a fight not that long ago. Opponent couldn't make the walk. That opponent, Manel Cobb. Nevada State Athletic Commission said, we don't want to see that pulsing action in your bloodstream. So Manel gets a fight over his last time out in Singapore, and he's probably not going to fight Nevada for a little bit, where the UFC has most of their fights at the apex. So for Sumedergi, good shot against Matt Schnell, a guy who unfortunately had lost his mother in the fight camp leading up to his fight against Brandon Royval. And for the people out there on Twitter that say one-round fights never get fight of the nights, Matt Schnell's fight against Brandon Royval was a one-round fight of the night where he drops Royval and then he decides to play touch butt in the park on the ground and gets submitted.
I'm sorry, but I have to throw you under the bus a little bit. You were a firm believer of one-round fights should not get fight of the nights.
No, they should. It's just they don't happen very often, and some of them, I like to see them play out longer. That's all.
I'm a big fan of a one-round FOTN. This is a weird fight, though, because these guys are the exact opposites of each other when you think about their resume and their record. Matt Schnell has fought some of the best fighters in this division. Fuck guys like Pantoja, fuck guys like Brandon Royval. Like, those are two of the best fighters in this division.
Bonterin's another loss, but so is Rob Font at 135.
So he's only lost to amazing fighters, whereas Sumedergi has been waiting to break through the ice for the very longest time. Now, Hector Sandoval's not
great.
That's
the other one, yeah.
Well, he has a very bad chin. I'm going to get to that. Don't worry. So for Matt Schnell, what I do really like is his technique. He does have great submission ability. He does have good striking when you just look at it in a freeze frame. But again, we talk about one of these guys every single card. How good is he at mixing his martial arts? It's like water and oil when you look at it. They are very two distinguished parts of his game to where, okay, Matt Schnell's boxing. He looks good. And then it's, oh, wait, now he's getting out grappled. Like, a lot of Matt Schnell's fights, he looks good until he gets hit by a very big shot, and the whole entire complexity of the fight changes. And fighting a guy like Sumedergi, who moves, I don't know if he moves too much just yet, if we're being honest. It's still something I'm trying to figure out. I think it's going to be really interesting to see if Matt Schnell can corner Sumedergi, up against the cage, because I think that's going to be really important. Sumedergi's a difficult guy to hit in the middle of the cage because he does move his feet so well. So I really do think Matt Schnell's whole game plan is going to have to figure out, okay, how do I not fight in the whole entire octagon? How do I just pick a corner of it? If I can just pick that corner to kind of box Sumedergi in, I do think Matt Schnell can have a lot of success, but he has to catch a guy who might have some of the best feet we've seen in the division.
Yeah, the really weird thing about this is Matt Schnell used to train out of American Top Team. Sumedergi's focused his American training at American Top Team with guys like Alessandre Pantoja, with Adriano Moraes, the champ over with ONE Championship, who's going to be fighting Demetrius Johnson on like Amazon Prime with ONE Championship, because they never have fights anymore and they try and do these fancy things with all the money they have.
But I like KSW a lot more is all I'm going to say.
Where's the fun stuff, ONE Championship? Let's do Big Brother. That's not fights. Let's do video games. But where are the video games,
Don't they do
games,
like
Matt?
What was the show with Donald Trump?
Big Brother. Or not Big Brother, The Apprentice.
That's what I mean. Apprentice, yeah.
Apprentice.
That's very strange that it does seem like most of the time I hear about ONE Championship, it's not about the fighting, it's about the other stuff.
I like burgers at Harvey's. It's a Canadian thing, but they throw a lot of shit at the fan. They do deep fried pickles. They do like frozen Red Bulls now. Just stick to what you're good at. ONE Championship. Put on fun fights. Don't do the rest of the crap.
But I gotta be... Now Burger King's talking to me, but that's another point.
But when I look at this one, Matt, for Matt Schnell, I mean, he is the underdog in this matchup. But let the cat out of the bag early, because this fight's at flyweight. Making weight at flyweight's a thing for Matt Schnell. Making weight at bantamweight is as well. So it definitely drains a lot out of him. But I just look at this one as Sumedergi has better footwork. Matt Schnell, when he turns the danger, danger, high voltage on and he decides to press forward, he has a lot of success. He doesn't do it very often because he's had his chin checked. So normally he's a defensive boxer. And that's worked. That's won him fights. But the trouble is, like, I look at Matt Schnell, you look at the split decision win he has over Tyson Nam, kind of weird that it's even a split decision. I thought Schnell won that one comfortably, 2-1. And then his other win, his last big win, was a submission win over forever wrestler but never striker, Jordan Espinoza. I look at the losses, Bonterin, and again, Pantoja, where he gets finished about 2.5 years ago. I don't like a guy with a suspect chin down a weight class, but I preface this by saying it feels like mirror force in a trap fight because Matt Schnell is the more complete mixed martial artist than Sumedergi from what I've seen. And Sumedergi, when he was fighting on the Chinese regional scene with WLF Wars...
I didn't think he was great.
Oh, yeah, I didn't either, and I didn't think he was going to be much in the UFC. He was also bantamweight back then, but he was a younger guy cutting down to 125, so you kind of... You can realize it at 125 versus Matt Schnell at 125.
Look, I'm not above giving myself credit when I think a prospect is going to be good and they end up being really good. I'm not above also telling you guys when I'm absolutely wrong. I didn't think Sue Muttergy would be a fighter in the UFC for more than like two or three fights. I really thought he did move too much on his feet, didn't sit down enough on his shots, and he is a natural striker, so I just didn't know how he was going to be able to get results at the UFC level. But throughout his last three fights, he has shown the ability to not only make adjustments in camp, but make adjustments in fights, and I do think that's going to be the important part of this fight, because let's say Matt Schnell is able to corner him. He is doing a good job getting him up against the cage. I don't think Sue Muttergy is the type of fighter at this stage of his career who's going to go, okay, I lost that first round. Let's go back to doing the exact same thing I did in the last round. I really do like the footwork out of Muttergy, but again, I have to preface that by saying he might almost do it too much, and I do think that that could get him caught if he does end up fighting a Pantoja next or someone like that, because that's the problem with Matt Schnell. Yes, he's lost to a lot of the better fighters in this division, but the second you beat him, you then have to go on and fight some of those great fighters in the division. And even if you really like Sue Muttergy at this stage of his career, and let's say he knocks out Matt Schnell in the first round, I still don't think I've seen enough to say, oh wow, he can go in there with an Askar Askarov or an Alejandro Pantoja. He's still probably going to need a few more wins of those like 5 to 10 guys, I would say, for him to finally get into the elite. But I really do think this fight against Matt Schnell is the perfect matchmaking, because if Schnell wins, okay, he might not be of the top tier flyweights, but he's good enough to beat most guys in the rankings. And on the flip side, Sue Muttergy could get the biggest win of his career, which could absolutely set him off.
Alessandro Pantoja says no to that one. It seems like a silly fight. And for Sue Muttergy, after his last win over Zelruk Adashev, he's taken about a year and a half off because he had a knee injury that required surgery. So he was getting ready for that Manel Kopp.
And with a guy who moves a lot, that's concerning.
And Manel Kopp, definitely a bigger name and a bigger fighter at 125 in terms of recognition and win recognition than Matt Schnell. But we'll focus on it from an odds perspective. Sue Muttergy opened -230, -254. Schnell opened +195, +205 right now. We have a look at the votes on Tapology. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Sue Muttergy.
I think it'll be closer because I think Schnell's the more known commodity.
79% Sue Muttergy on 690 total votes. You got 39% by decision, 51% by knockout. For the 21% that have Schnell, 55% by decision, 29% by submission.
I'm surprised.
Obviously, Smolka was able to out-wrestle Sue Muttergy in Sue Muttergy's UFC debut, and he submitted him, an opportunity for Schnell. I think Schnell could have success with the boxing. I think he could have success with the takedowns and the submissions. I think 125 is a tough cut, and I think Sue Muttergy with his length over most fighters, but not in this fight because they're both going to match up height-wise and reach-wise the same. I'm just eager to see these guys on Friday. And again, I said trap card at the start of the week. I feel like Matt Schnell could win as an underdog, so it does scare me making a pick on this one.
So when I said Matt Schnell only lost to Elite, I saw you go, and I was going to get to this point. Hector Sandoval's not good at all and knocked out Matt Schnell with a backwards hammer fist that he only landed one time after Schnell was going for a heel hook. I'm not confident in Matt Schnell's chin at this weight class whatsoever, and I do really worry about him fighting an accurate striker who can strike off the back foot, who does use his movement very well, because that's the thing. If Sue Muttergy's feet were even 5% slower, I do think that there's a world where Matt Schnell is able to corner him. I just think that that footwork is going to help him evade a lot of the offense of Matt Schnell throughout this matchup.
Both of us going with Sue Muttergy. I'm in agreement there. I like those shots, and I really do like that left that he throws straight down that pipe, and there's a lot of power on those shots as well. So both of us going with the Tibetan Eagle in this matchup.
Really fun fight.
Again, and a lot of red flags too. Schnell's got a great opportunity to showcase some of his grappling in this matchup, and for Sue Muttergy, he gets to show some wrinkles that we might not have seen yet in the UFC tenure. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have and some big time fights left on this card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Interesting fight on the main card of this weekend's UFC on ABC3. We have the ranked, 14th ranked to be specific, the Leech Li Jingliang taking on the formerly ranked King of Kung Fu, Muslim Salikov. For Salikov, his nickname's the King of Kung Fu, which is a martial art that Bruce Buffer always shouted out before Roy Nelson did his belly rub on the top of the cage. I guess it would have been before he did that.
A Kung Fu fighter.
He was a Kung Fu fighter, but for Muslim Salikov, he's a Wushu Sanda fighter, and he's not just a Wushu Sanda fighter. He is regarded as the best Wushu Sanda fighter of all time. And if you don't believe me, go watch some of those fights. In kickboxing or just overall striking, his record is 185 wins, 13 losses, and 1 draw. In 2008, at the appendage to the Beijing Olympic Games, Muslim Salikov won gold. He is widely regarded as one of the best pure strikers in striking fashion, and in MMA, that's guided him to an 18-2 overall record. And you watch this guy's fights, like, I mean, yeah, to get into the UFC, Matt, who did he beat?
I can't remember off the top of my head.
You can't remember
have notes in front of you. I do this for my head.
You can't remember who it was, but if you go and watch it, it was that spinning head kick knockout win over Melvin Gallard. He then got out-wrestled by Alex Garcia and submitted, so a lot of people thought, hey, this guy isn't going to be much. But he beat Ricky Rainey, Bellator's formerly owned Wonderboy teammate. He beat Nurdin Taleb by finish. Then he's beaten Laureano Staropoli, Eliseu Zaleski dos Santos in one of the worst fights you can watch. And then Francisco Trinaldo in a fight where he got out-wrestled by Trinaldo, who kind of pushed him down into one of the takedowns. He also landed one of the most wicked combos. As Trinaldo entered in, you had Mr. Muslim Salikov land a short right hand that stunned him. And then he went Super Saiyan and just went bam, 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 landed four punches, dropped him, ended up on top, finished the round on top in the first round. But Matt, for Muslim Salikov, it's just inactivity that's kind of plagued him throughout his UFC career. The same can be said for Li Jingliang. But Matt, I think this is a wild fight. I think you go crazy. I think you drink like a Faygo and you get wicked and weird, because I think we're in for an interesting fight this weekend.
Yeah, da, 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 da. Blueberry Fuego, that's all I can think of right now. This is a really fun fight, but this is my thing with Muslim Salikov. He's not in his prime anymore, no matter what you think of him. He just isn't. He is a little bit slower, he is a little bit more gun-shy, but he can still get wins at the UFC level, because I do agree with you. He is so good at what he is good at that he just knows how to translate his skills in MMA, and I think that's a really important thing. It's like when people were calling, hey, Sean Strickland, he's going to take down Alex Pereira, and we were here saying, well, he doesn't normally go for takedowns. I doubt he's just going to do that all of a sudden. It is the truth. You're not going to become something that you haven't been throughout your tenure as an MMA fighter. And I don't all of a sudden expect Muslim Salikov to go in there and just up his volume and become a much more dangerous fighter in this fight. And I hate it when people disagree with decisions all the time, but I did think Eliseu Zaleski did enough to beat Muslim Salikov in their fight. I agree with you though, awful fight, low volume, so nobody really won, for being honest. It's not like either guy was able to separate themselves enough to where they really have an argument for being robbed. But for Salikov, he does have weird accuracy on his shots, and that's really the thing that I want to talk about, because sometimes, like you said, he will land really nice combinations on the inside, but then at other points, his opponents will leave themselves wide open when they do throw their own strikes, and he'll just sort of wait on the back foot, not really do anything by it. And just the baseball mind in me thinks, okay, he's setting him up for something in the future. Pitchers do this, batters also do this. But for Salikov, it's almost like there isn't any payoff at the end of it. And it does remind me of when Jan Blachowicz fought Israel Adesanya. Joe Rogan, that whole entire fight was like, wow, look at the feints of Izzy. Look at the feints of Izzy. Feints are great, but they're not control and they're not damage. And those are the only two things the judges care about. So for Salikov, I think what he does is very, very good, but I do think at a certain point he's going to have to switch his style to make it more suited for MMA, because Salikov right now is a really good fighter outside of the rankings, but at what, 38 years of age, I'm very curious to see what can he do to actually go on some kind of a run, because he's not just another guy in the organization. You know, he's 18-2, he's been on a very impressive win streak, over impressive names, I should say, maybe not the performances themselves. I'm just very curious as to what does Salikov do after this performance, because in my mind, Li Jingliang is still on a title path. I know he lost to Chimaev, but I still think Li Jingliang every morning wakes up thinking, how can I become welterweight champion?
Yeah, the weirdest part about this, and I mentioned it, so both these guys have the same problem. For Muslim Salikov, again, it's inactivity. Like, one fight in 2018, two fights in 2019, one in 2020, and then one in 2021. For Li Jingliang, same thing. Three fights in 2018, one in 2019, one in 2020, and one in 2021. And when you look at Li Jingliang, you think, wow, this guy can mix it up with his striking and his grappling. He came into the UFC from Legacy FC. Legacy merged with RFA to become LFA. He was their champ at welterweight. Love that when a prospect from outside of North America comes in, fights with Legacy. It wasn't just one fight, it was multiple fights, then makes an impact in the UFC. But again, this is the craziest part for Li Jingliang. 9 knockdowns for, 5 knockdowns against.
And not against great fighters either. Not to cut you off and make this mine, but Bobby Nash was able to drop him. Jake Matthews dropped him multiple times. Jake Matthews is a good fighter, don't get me wrong, but some of the fighters who have been able to damage Li Jingliang are not the types of fighters you would think would be able
the
to do
it. The double-edged sword, the kick against David Zavada that ended up finishing him, the finish over Elize Uzaleski dos Santos, what he's able to do in that fight, that's my the con and the pro to the knockdowns. You got to break him down fight by fight. But for Li Jingliang, he's been in the UFC for a long time. 15 fights. He's 10-5. He has 5 fight of the nights, one against Frank Camacho, one against Jake Matthews. Eye poke gate or eye gouge gate.
It was a great fight, though, to be honest.
Performance bonuses against Santiago Ponzinibbio, where he landed that straight shot, finished him. Zaleski, Zavada, and Zach Otto. So he has trained a lot out of China Top Team. He's really been a mentor for a lot of fighters coming into the UFC. And then on the flip side, getting ready for this one and acclimating himself to the States, he's been training out of Killcliff FC. It's a stupid name and I'm still not used to it. Robbie Lawler hanging out with him a lot, which is interesting.
Good training partner.
You like to see that. But again, the one thing I see out of Li Jingliang that could get him caught in this fight, he overextends a lot in his shots and he leaves his head out and then throws his arms. You do that against Muslim Salikov, you get knocked out. The counter to that is Li Jingliang leads in a lot of his fights and Muslim Salikov doesn't. However, Muslim, even at 38, I thought against Elize Uzaleski dos Santos, as close as that fight was, I don't care who you thought that won, it's a win or a loss, whatever. Muslim looked really slow and old in that fight. Against Trinaldo, who I get it.
Another old and slow
guy. Trinaldo's in his 40s, but he pressures the action in that fight on every single in-between. Salikov landed with reckless abandon. And the other thing is, Salikov in some of these fights against lesser fighters has been able to get the takedowns against Staropoli. The one against Trinaldo that I count as a real takedown. Because one of them, against Trinaldo, he just pushed him and then he landed on top. It was a takedown, but it wasn't much of one. Salikov can incorporate those bits to his game, but it's not his main part. It is the flashy striking, the speed, and the accuracy. So I love this matchup for what it's worth. Both guys' average fight time is less than 15 minutes. There's a lot of finishes out there, but I think these guys stylistically match up very well, height-wise, size-wise, and everything all in between.
No, and I agree a lot with what you said about Li Jingliang leading the dance. I think that's going to be really important for this fight because Salikov does like to strike on the back foot, and sometimes he can be almost uncomfortable closing distance himself because he is wary of the counter shots from his opponent. If Li Jingliang is moving forward, boxing you, that's a really tough place to be in. Like, I think a lot of Elise's Zaleski dos Santos. Li Jingliang made him look like he didn't even belong in the UFC. That was one of the most one-sided fights I've ever been excited for in my whole life. Jingliang got in the inside, made it ugly, used uppercuts really well in that matchup, and I really do think that's the technique.
I was the one that put him down. I set a straight shot for some reason. It was an uppercut and tight.
And that's what I think is going to be really important in this fight too, because Salikov's someone who likes to have a very high guard. He brings his elbows up to his eyes. That's the way I always think about it with a high guard, because your arms are very high. Li Jingliang is the type of guy who loves to go to the body with his kicks, goes to the body with his boxing combinations, and when he's not afraid of the offensive takedown from his opponent, he's much more willing to get into a brawl, and I think those are all situations that are just really tough for a 38-year-old Muslim Salikov to deal with. If he was 5 years younger and a little bit more aggressive, I would have a much better time picking Salikov, but the issue is, he looked great against a 40-year-old who used to be a lightweight, who doesn't really belong in this weight division. I don't think that's enough for me to be confident in you to then go on to beat Li Jingliang, who, yes, he didn't look good in the Chimaev win, or the Chimaev loss, but no one looks good against Khamzat Chimaev other than Gilbert Burns.
Like Dos Anjos against Fazeev last night, you saw the cut on Dos Anjos' arm. You heard his coach saying, hey, stop blocking the kicks with your arm. What do? Just let them hit you? But when you do watch this fight, Li Jingliang holds his hands about mid-range. They're not really high. They're not really low. So you can try and block everything in between. Muslim Salikov's best shot is his right kick to the body, and he throws it like Joe Rogan on Instagram. You know, a big noise?
Sure, St. Pierre, I don't know if you know this, but I'm one of the great spinning back kickers of all time.
The big noise, though, for Salikov in his fights, his body kicks are legendary. He's an honored master of sport in Wushu Sanda. He's also a master of sport in complex martial arts. When we look at the odds in this fight, my guy, Muslim Salikov, a guy that I do talk about a lot, open minus 140, minus 175 for Li Jingliang off his loss where he didn't land a single anything against Khamzat Chimaev. Plus 120 at open, plus 145 now, Matt. We have a look at the Tapology votes. They're a surprise to us as they are to you. Muslim Salikov's a favorite, so I'll say over under. I think it's close. I'm going to say over under 65% Salikov.
I'm going to say under. I think Jingliang is going to be the favorite.
No. 740 total votes, 69% Salikov, 79% by decision for the 31% that have Li Jingliang, 34% by decision, 59% by knockout.
What? Really? He knocked out Elysio, who had never been knocked out.
He knocked out Eliseu, and he did knock out Santiago Ponzinibbio on those close-range shots. Just to me, Muslim Salikov and Tite's a guy that you don't mess around with. Obviously, Jingliang's been able to do those
Santiago's
things.
Santiago's so much better than him.
Santiago was coming off a long layoff,
but
too.
Still, it's a guy who wasn't his prime, though. This is the thing. If Li Jingliang loses this fight, it's because he's pursuing a win and gets hit by a big shot. If Salikov wins this fight, it's probably going to be on the back foot reacting to what Li Jingliang's doing. That's fine, but I would much rather side with the guy who's pushing the action throughout the fights. And with Salikov, I think he has average punching power. I really don't think he has, like, top-tier upper echelon punching power. This could be the fight where I'm wrong, because Li Jingliang doesn't have the greatest chin of all time, like you had established with the knockdowns. I didn't realize he had been dropped himself 5 times, and it was quite a few, but 5 is a concerning amount. I still think he's the much better boxer, though, when it gets on the inside. Salikov is a great striker, but when you're a great striker, it means you use every single part of your body, and that includes kicks. Li Jingliang fights with a lot of pressure, which does eliminate the kicks from a lot of his opponents. If Santiago Ponzinibbio can't even kick you to the leg or to the body, I do think his pressure is going to eventually get to Salikov, similar to what it did his last two upper echelon opponents he was able to beat.
I like Li Jingliang in this fight. I think he's going to be able to boogie woogie woo his way to a win if you're a big ICP fan. But when I do look at this one, I mean, Jingliang, he pressures, but he doesn't throw a lot of volume, but neither does Muslim Salikov. So each guy has to make those power shots count. Again, both guys, average fight time is less than 15 minutes, so we could very well see a finish in this one. Maybe that's what you want to go with. I do like Li Jingliang ever so slightly. A little bit more volume, a little bit more well-rounded, but I'm really eager to see this fight because I've been hyping up Muslim Salikov in our videos since we were 2 studios ago. So exactly. I can't wait for this one. You know I'm excited about it. I'm going to be watching the Saskatchewan Roughriders more than likely as this fight's going on.
I saw Darian Durant in his prime. It was beautiful.
Darian Durant. And then last weekend, there was a guy that took out the quarterback at the knees. So that was disgusting. But when it does come down to this fight, both of us in agreement with the Leech, let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Couple of big fights left on this card, including perennial main event co-main eventer Michelle Waterson taking on Amanda Lemos, and in the main event, Brian Ortega, Yair Rodriguez. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend, an interesting matchup at flyweight. Yes, flyweight. We have Michelle Waterson, the karate hottie, the former Invicta 105-pound champion, that's Adam Waite, taking on the former Jungle Fights bantamweight champ, Amanda Lemos. And when we look at this fight, for Michelle Waterson in the UFC, she's had one prelim fight. It was against the now former, and well, she was the former champ then, but now she's the current champ, Carla Esparza. You look at it for Michelle Waterson, the resume is very impressive. She's beaten good fighters. She's lost to very good fighters. But I look at this overall, Matt. I mean, 4 main events. 1-3 in those main events. The one win is a split decision over Angela Hill. And she's had 1 co-main event slot as well. For Waterson, one of the more well-known fighters in the UFC. She was originally supposed to take on Amanda Ribas a few months ago. She posted to Instagram. It was a little cryptic. She wouldn't really say what happened. She just basically said, I have an injury. If I went any further with training and fighting, it could be career-ending. So I'm going to take time to clean it up. So then I listened to an interview 2 weeks ago with Middle Easy. Try and guess who did the interview. I'll save you the suspense. It was James Lynch. And James Lynch asked about the interview, and she gave the same answer, which gives me a little bit of pause that she wasn't talking about it. Topology says knee injury, but I don't know exactly what it was, so I won't speculate too much. But she doesn't talk about it. She's incredibly cryptic, which is kind of weird. For Waterson, I mean, you look at the 5-1-in, it is 2-3. But again, consider that a lot of 5-round fights. You look at the wins. Karolina Kovalkiewicz about 3 years and 3 months ago, lost to Joanna Jędrzejczyk, lost to Carla Esparza by split decision, beats Angela Hill by split decision her last time out at 125, oddly. About a year ago, she loses to Marina Rodriguez, and she didn't have a lot of success. She was on the back foot about 95% of that fight.
And Amanda Lemos is like Marina Rodriguez if she had less volume and way more power. I don't know how Michelle Waterson wins this fight, and I normally don't like saying that in our videos, but this could just be like an exercise for our commenters, or really just the community, to also bring up reasons why they think Michelle Waterson's gonna win, because that, yeah, that bullshit sidekick ain't doing shit to Amanda Lemos, because Amanda Lemos doesn't care about how much power you have. She has 5 times as much. Now, that did catch her against Jessica Andrade. She basically ran at her, pulled her head down, and submitted her. But no one can do, like, people don't realize this when I say it. Jessica Andrade is a Hall of Famer. She's not just a Hall of Famer. She's easily one of the greatest women's MMA fighters of all time. Probably top three if we're being completely honest with ourselves. She's fought in every women's weight class other than featherweight because it's not a real division and had real wins in each and every one of those weight classes against number one contenders.
The UFC doesn't have her featured at pay-per-view cards and fight night cards doing this, being like, hey, it's Jessica Andrade. She's a big deal. Big deal.
And when she fought Joanna for the title at 211, like, that was a really big fight at the time. And that's what I always go back to with Michelle Waterson. When she was in her prime, it was when there was that three-headed monster of the division. It was when Joanna, Weili, and Rose were going back and forth, just switching the title between themselves, and Andrade would jump up and have a chance at it too. It's just those four fighters were head and shoulders ahead of Michelle Waterson. And I don't like saying that, it's just the truth. Like, those are four genuine championship-quality fighters that Waterson did feel like she was almost stagnant with her own progression during that time. I never felt like Michelle Waterson really improved on her game after she had left Invicta. And you have to remember, she was so young in her career when she did come over to the UFC that now she's, what, 36 years old? Like, when we were first talking about Michelle Waterson, when she had that Fox main event against Paige VanZant, she was in her late 20s, early 30s, and people really thought that she was going to be one of the future faces of this division. She's had a lot of memorable fights, but like you bring up with her main event record, she is only 1-3 in main events, and you only get main events when you fight the best fighters of your division. So that kind of tells you where Michelle Waterson fits with the other elite fighters of flyweight and strawweight.
When I look at it for Waterson, she's somebody that trained out of Jackson Wink, then kind of trained adjacent to Jackson Wink, now back at Jackson Wink again. And to bring it back to James Lynch's interview with her a couple of weeks ago, he asked her a question about training with Amanda Lemos because Lemos had spent some time at Jackson's. And, you know, to paraphrase, she basically said, yeah, Amanda was really strong, but that was a long time ago, whatever. When I hear Amanda was very strong, like, Amanda Lemos used to be a bantamweight. Had that wicked fight against Leslie Smith where she gets finished. And then slowly drops down to 115. Beats Mizuki. Wins these fights. Beats Montserrat Canejo. Beats fighters that she should beat. And then obviously loses to Jessica Andrade. But when I do look at this, she had that really close fight against Angela Hill too. And you could have made an argument that if the first round was a 10-9 and Hill won the last two, that Hill won that fight. But Hill has an argument against both these fighters. Regardless, the fact that Lemos is stronger, that this one's at 125, that Michelle Waterson is not going to go for her own takedown. She has decent jiu-jitsu, but it's more defensive to get out of bad spots, to get back up to her feet. She's got the sidekick, she's got the volume, but if she's on the back foot against Lemos, I have a hard time. I think she has a better opportunity in a three-round fight in this atmosphere than she does in a five.
I'm going to disagree. And I just want to say
just a second. This one being in a cage that's going to be normal size in Long Island, that could also play to her advantage as well. You never know.
I got to be honest. I think in a five-round fight, it wouldn't be enough for me to pick Waterson, but I do think that would be more towards her style. Just when you watch the way Lemos was struggling with the impact or just the overall output of Angela Hill, I do think that Lemos is going to tire as a lot of her fights are going to progress, whereas Waterson, it might not be these flashy strikes that are doing a lot of damage, but at least she is active enough in those last two rounds to where I think she could make it a little bit more competitive. I just have no idea how Michelle Waterson stops the forward pressure of Amanda Lemos, because I know both these fighters are strawweights, if we're being honest, but Lemos is going to match up physically to a lot more flyweights than Michelle Waterson will. Michelle Waterson looks undersized at strawweight, if we're being very honest. Like, her fight against Rose Namajunas was super one-sided, and it was because A, Rose is very good, of course, but Rose head kicks her, takes her down, gets her back. She really just dominated in every area of that fight. And the fact that I've seen Michelle Waterson struggle with not just power-oriented strikers, but very technical strikers in the past, makes me think that unless, like you did, her little front kick there to the side is able to just get off and she can bounce on her back foot and keep her head out of danger, I think Amanda Lemos, like, this is her fight to lose.
Robert Paul Champagne, get off, Matt, when it comes down to this one. Waterson also said to James Lynch, and I want to make sure that I mention this one, talks about her movie career that's blossoming. She's going to be in the movie Havoc on Netflix with Tom Hardy.
I like Tom Hardy.
She got training in over in Wales when they were getting ready for that one, but I don't like that. Matt, the odds in this one, Lemos is a favorite. She opened minus 400, minus 380 right now. For Waterson, open plus 300, plus 288. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise that's there to you. A lot more fans, Michelle Waterson, but I'm going to say over under 65% Lemos.
I think that's a good place to set it. I'll say over, but not by much.
Oh boy. 767 total votes, 85% for Amanda Lemos, 67% by decision, 23% by knockout. For the 15% that have Waterson, 80% by decision. Matt, both of us going with Amanda Lemos.
Without a doubt.
Not leaving much to the imagination. Matt, I'd like to hear from the commenters down below. Michelle Watterson. 4 main events, 1 co-main event. She's had 1 prelim spot and many main card spots, even main cards on pay-per-views as well. So a big-time opportunity for both of these women to get a win on ABC down in the Etats-Unis. Matt, a big opportunity in this one. And a big-time main event. We have Brian Ortega taking on Yair Rodriguez. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Big time main event coming up this weekend at Featherweight. We have the former title challenger, Triangle City, T-City, Brian Ortega, taking on El Pantera, Yair Rodriguez, walking fight of the nights. And as always, one half, you're hosting to a Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, Craig Allen FNP, with me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen FNP, on the respective socials. Matt, we had a wild week last weekend. Question mark kicks
9-2
off. And for question mark kicks, that's usually 2 hours before the prelims. You folks hitting up the comment section, hitting up the channel, you know the drill. But this weekend, a little bit of a change because these fights are going to be early. And I'm away this weekend watching my beloved Saskatchewan Rough Riders down in Nova Scotia. So if you see me, I'm going to be wearing this Rough Rider shirt. You can say hi. I don't bite. But Matt, when it does come to this fight, I mean, for Brian Ortega, he's been in 5 fight of the nights. For Yair Rodriguez, he has been in 5 fight of the nights. These guys don't know boring fights. And for Rodriguez, in certain fights, he's been taken down, like the end of his fight against Jeremy Stephens or the beginning of his fight against Frankie Edgar, the former champion. But oh, by the way, his striking is so good that he's had the rally back comeback against the Korean Zombie. He had the great fight against Max Holloway's last time out that was one of those fight of the nights. He didn't win, but man, it takes 2 to tango. And for Ortega, didn't win his last fight, was sizably outstruck, but almost finished the fight against Volkanovski with those crazy submissions. But you look at it for Ortega, he's been sizably outstruck in 3 of his fights. The fight that he had against Volkanovski, the fight that he had against Max Holloway, the fight that he had against Renato Moicano, and he's 1-2 of those matchups.
You can go way further. The fight he had against Clay Guida, the fight he had against, like, Thiago Tavares. Like, Brian Ortega gets outstruck in a lot of his fights.
He's gotten outstruck in some of his fights. But the point that I want to make out of this is we've definitely seen a progression out of Ortega since he came into the UFC 1 and it was overturned to a no contest because USADA said, But if you do look at it for Ortega, you understand why the nickname is T-City. And does he win every fight by triangle? Not necessarily, but going back and watching his fights, and it definitely is a treat if you take the time to go back and watch them. My biggest one that I love to watch, the fight against Cub Swanson, where they go back and forth a little bit. In the end of the first round, he latches onto a tight submission that somehow Swanson recovers from. He backs Swanson up against the cage. He grabs the guillotine, arm in, and then he just pulls on it for dear life, gets the submission win there. Ortega is that grappler at featherweight to the nth degree, and his striking leveled up after his time away from Holloway to his fight against the Korean Zombie, where he looked like a new man, and he had body kicks and leg kicks that we've never seen before.
And elbows.
So I love this matchup on paper because Yair Rodriguez is one of the most creative strikers in the UFC, and it might surprise people. He came in off the Ultimate Fighter Latin America Season 1 in 2014. UFC 180 was the debut.
It's wild how long he has been in the UFC for, especially the fact that he's 29 years old, but it feels like he's been a part of our lives for much longer, you know? And like you said, he hasn't really been active, but he's always been on the outskirts of the division, always sort of watching out, just trying to get that one big profile win. And this is a weird fight, and this is a fight that tells you that records are for DJs. I don't care what these guys' recent records have been, and I don't care that Yair and Brian Ortega are both coming off of a loss. You know why I don't care? Because they're coming off losses to 2 of the greatest fighters ever, and Yair Rodriguez pushed Max Holloway, honestly, to a level that we've never seen in a Max Holloway win. And on the flip side, Brian Ortega almost finished Volkanovski multiple times in their fight, and if he was fighting a fighter who had any less will in them, he probably would have been able to submit them, because if you go back and watch those fights with Volkanovski, Volkanovski's head when he's strangled is purple. The rest of his body is pale like me. And that tells you just how tight the squeeze of Brian Ortega is. And the flip side is, Volkanovski might be able to fight out of some of these positions because he is so resilient. He's so strong in pretty much every area of MMA. Yair is a great striker. He's phenomenal. Like you said, a true one of one in this sport. But we have seen him struggle with some guys on the mat, and it does make me think that this fight is as clear as. If Brian Ortega even gets one takedown during this fight, I truly am concerned for Yair Rodriguez and his ability to get back up to his feet. The one thing I do like out of Yair, he is really good at getting his feet on the hips of fighters when they're on top of him, and he can push off, do that one big action that lets him get back up to his feet. I think he's going to really need push-ups and get-ups like that in this fight, because let's say he does go to try to you know, frame off, push off, be intelligent about it. That's where Brian Ortega can progress and do that really slow thing that you see guys like Charles Oliveira, Brian Ortega do, where it's not just a jump from full guard into full mount, because those are very sexy to see. Brian Ortega can do it very slow, though. He'll be in your full guard. Next thing you know, he's kind of halfway on your back. Next thing you know, you're getting up to your feet, but oh no, Brian Ortega's on your back up against the cage. He just never stops grappling no matter where the fight is, and that's something that I hope Yair and his team have really worked on.
I mean, for Yair Rodriguez, I threw it out there as his gym, because he's trained in Mexico for this one. He trains in the States as well, but I threw Izzy Wrestling out there because he has worked a lot with Izzy Martinez for his wrestling. And I mean, you consider it for Yair Rodriguez. Fight of the Nights against Holloway Stevens, Korean Zombie, Caceres, and Charles Rosa. Performance bonuses over Andre Feely, BJPenn.com, and the Korean Zombie. But when you do look at this fight, Matt, for Yair Rodriguez, taking on a guy in Jeremy Stevens that will switch stance to put fighter the southpaw, that body kick was there. Nearly finished Stevens with the body kick and then the follow-up. But Stevens rallied after round one and round two. Almost got finished in round two. To round three, where he was taking Yair Rodriguez down quite a bit in that one.
But I do think that was one of those situations where Yair burned his tank out going for the finish. He was doing those, like, Alexander Semen hammer fists. Like, he was really going to try to get the finish in that fight. And I did like his cardio in the Max Holloway fight his next time out. I do agree with you a lot. I've always worried about Yair in a five-round atmosphere because it's kind of like with Zabit. People always thought it was really critical on Zabit in his career. But my thing is, if you throw wheel kicks, I just think you should land them every now and then. That's all. Call me old-fashioned that way. At least when Yair does decide to throw these crazy techniques, the majority of the time they are landing. Like, go back to the Andre Feely fight. That was absolutely insane. He basically, there's a weird kind of scramble where Andre Feely's against or across the cage from Yair. Yair, with the most confident posture you've ever seen, just runs across the cage and throws like a double flying kick. Like, Yair does stuff as he's figuring it out in the cage. And no matter what level of preparation you have, there really isn't anybody who can get you ready for the striking style of Yair Rodriguez.
And I mean, you look at it for Rodriguez, this will be his sixth main event. It's going to be Brian Ortega's fifth main event opportunity. And again, I mentioned that southpaw to orthodox thing because for Ortega, primarily out of southpaw, but he will switch over to orthodox a little bit to open up some of his striking. So I'm interested to see for how long Ortega decides to strike against a guy like Rodriguez, who has decent volume, decent power, and he has the ability to switch things up when he is striking. You look at the odds in this fight. Ortega is the favorite. Open minus 150, minus 165 right now. For Yair Rodriguez, opened a plus 130, plus 137 or thereabouts on Best Fight Odds. When we talk about these main events, Matt, we throw it out to the YouTube community tab. You folks hit us up with your comments. 1,200 total votes right now. 59% going with Ortega, 41% with Yair Rodriguez. Hanky's saying, I think Yair's kicks will cause some troubles for Ortega, but I think he will get it done on the mat. I assume you're thinking Ortega's going to get it done on the mat. We into Fieldhouse saying, I will be in attendance, first UFC card.
What an amazing first card to be at. Like, hopefully you really enjoy it, because this is, like, top tier for fight night cards.
New York, New York, Rochelle, Matt. Matrix saying Ortega by submission. We've got Jamie saying Ortega, no striking. Yeah, you're all day. Jamie, have you watched the last few Brian Ortega fights? Jack Green saying Ortega by sub extremely early. Yair has very bad takedown defense. And Chad saying Ortega for the win. Need the rebound. Can't wait for the analysis, boys. Chad, we got it locked and loaded. So, Matt, again, for Ortega, obviously he's improved with the striking. You've seen that through his last number of fights. Ruka Sport with some great people to train with. And obviously, Jason Perillo, douche, when he's holding those mats. And you know, a guy who likes to make weird book bags for avocados at airports. I'm talking about Mr. Gracie. But Matt, for Brian Ortega, varied approach for Yair Rodriguez. The get-ups to strike, and he is a striker. So Matt, what's the pick here?
I have no idea, but this is what I'm going to do. Yair Rodriguez is like a Hall of Fame player at range. Like, if you want to fight Yair Rodriguez at range, get out of the sport. It's a really, really bad idea. Ortega can box. He is really good on the inside, but he doesn't do a lot of kicks himself, and he's not the best wrestler. That's the thing you have to remember. Brian Ortega has 10 out of 10 jiu-jitsu, and let's say 9 out of 10 striking. The one thing that he does lack of the elite is he doesn't really have the elite wrestling to just decide, okay, I know where the fight's going to take place. So for that reason, I do think there's a world where Yair is able to use his footwork, use his kicks, stay so far away from Brian Ortega that his wrestling never really does matter. But on the flip side of that, I really like what you brought up about the Cub Swanson fight. And this is the thing that stood out to me in the Cub Swanson fight. I feel like that was the first fight Brian Ortega's striking got better. And for this reason, do you know how he got Cub Swanson against the cage in the second round? He jabbed him there. He jabbed him all the way across the cage, got his back up against the fence, and then basically made him decide what bad decision do you want to make.
And he had good striking defense in that fight, too. And now he did hold his hands high, and he will hold them high. There's periods when it's at range, he can hold them low. When it's in close boxing quarters, he will hold them high. So something that you like to see out of an elite fighter. But it's one of those ones like Rodriguez, high hands, hit the body, like low hands, hit the head, and he can do that from distance. That's the thing.
This isn't a good example, but it's like, are you willing to put your hand in a blender to grab a piece of gold? Like, that's what this fight's going to be for Brian Ortega. You're going to have to do something absolutely insane to get this fight in your preferred range. And even at this stage of Yair's career, he did pretty good boxing against Max Holloway. It's not like Holloway just got on the inside and destroyed him once he got there. Like, Yair has enough pop at the end of his shots to where he can hurt his opponents just with his hands. And this is the last thing I'll say. How much damage is too much damage for Brian Ortega to take? Like, at a certain point, it is going to be too much. I don't know if this is the fight that it's going to be, but we have seen Brian Ortega take ungodly beatings throughout his career, and luckily his chin has been able to sustain its way throughout these crazy fights. But if he has another one of these with Yair, if we're in the fifth round, it's like a 49-46, a 47-47, and a 47-47. No one knows what the judge is there.
47-47.
Exactly. Just absolute chaos. No one knows what happened. Like, if it is one of those fight of the year type fights, is what I'm getting at. I just don't know how many of those Brian Ortega still has left in him, whereas Yair had a wild fight with a Korean Zombie, but he did end up winning that fight by knockout, and he had the wild fight with Max Holloway, but it's not like he got dropped in that fight. It's not like he did eat the type of damage that makes you think, wow, will he ever be the same? Brian Ortega needed a medical doctor to step in between his fight when he fought Max Holloway to say, like, no, I know you still want to fight, but you're too tough for your own good. And for that reason, ever so slightly, I'm going to pick Yair Rodriguez. I think on the outside, he can damage Ortega enough to make him be a more hesitant fighter with his own striking. And if Brian Ortega is more hesitant with his own striking, he won't be moving forward. And I really do think forward pressure is going to be the key for Ortega.
Yeah, you look at it for Ortega. If he's going to get the win, he's got to get it up against the cage. He really has to threaten. And you saw it against Moicano. He couldn't establish the distance. He kept getting outstruck. And then finally, at the end, he said, screw it. I'm just going to get in close and go for the guillotine. And it worked for him that fight. It worked for him in the Cub Swanson fight. It's worked for him in a lot of these fights, and we talk about the performance bonuses for Yair Rodriguez. I didn't mention it for Brian Ortega, but he does have two of them, Cub Swanson and then Frankie Edgar. One guy beat Frankie Edgar with his striking, Brian Ortega did, and Frankie Edgar beat Yair Rodriguez with his takedown and his submission. And when you look at it for Rodriguez, he struggled with takedown defense against traditional wrestlers. Brian Ortega isn't one of those. He's a upper body type of guy that's going to try and get you into a submission to take you down. Kind of like an Emmanuel Sanchez type.
So that's a really good comp.
I do like Brian Ortega with those. I think for Rodriguez, you're training wrestling takedown defense, and that's one of those ones you're going to train every different type of takedown defense, especially with a guy like Izzy Martinez. You're going to be working on your striking in Mexico as well as your takedown defense. I think Brian Ortega's leveled up his defensive striking to be good enough to crash the distance to then be able to get that win. But again, Korean Zombie, they were playing touch butt in the park. They were hugging, they were clapping, they were doing whatever. And then it just took an up elbow to finish him.
Did you ever have a person playing any sport in your life that maybe on the inside you felt like you were better than them, but you just didn't like the matchup? Like, I can think of, there was a guy who was point guard for Heartland, shout out to Heartland in New Brunswick. He wasn't great, but he was so fast that I was just like, oh, I gotta guard this guy in the fast break, and like, you know you're just gonna have a really bad workout by the end of the fight. I think Brian Ortega, if we just stacked his skills up against Yair Rodriguez, is probably the more skilled fighter because he does have more depth to his game. He doesn't just have the striking or just the grappling. He can use both. The problem is, I do think he is going to struggle with that offensive takedown against Yair. Like I said, Yair naturally stands very far away from his opponents, and has very good footwork. I think for those reasons, Ortega is really going to struggle to get the takedown. But I will say this, even if this is just contested on the feet, Brian Ortega is a good enough striker to make this a fight of the night style fight, even if he can't get the takedown.
Should be an amazing fight. We're split on the pick. Matt going with the Ultimate Fighter Latin America season one winner in 2014 on the Ultimate Fighter that was competed and contested at the end at UFC 180 Verdum versus Hunt. So Matt going with Yair Rodriguez. I'm going to go with Brian T. City Ortega, a guy who had a no contest in his UFC debut and has gone on to do wonderful things. His only two losses in his last three fights. So we're split on the pick. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. You folks are hitting us up with some great comments. We try our best to respond to those. It's a great community. The Fight Night Picks community. It's been getting insane. A guy named it way back when, hashtag Fight Night or Nation. And I thought that was pretty good way back then. But we don't hear it as much. So let us know who you have in these fights. Question mark kicks at the end of the week. It's probably going to be on Saturday morning. I'm going to be, you know, in a place. Guys, I got a wedding Friday night, and then I got the football game Saturday afternoon. So we'll figure this one out, but it will be out there at some point. We'll do something for you here on the channel. So stay tuned with that. But Matt, a wild week of fights.
I'm really excited for this fight night, Karen. I could not tell you the last time I've been as excited for a fight night as I normally am for a pay-per-view. But hopefully you guys understand. Like, the depth that this card has is absolutely insane. Charles Joldan versus Shane Burgos is going to be an absolutely wild fight. And that's just the precursor for what's going to be Brian Ortega versus Yair Rodriguez, which is one of those, like, universally beloved matchups. I see a lot of people out there who like Yair. I see a lot of people out there who like Brian Ortega. Two very popular fighters, but the consensus is everybody thinks this is going to be a great fight, and that's when you know you got a good one.
Big time fights coming up this weekend. You're not going to want to miss any of them. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it.